that this is Karen Brewster. Today is September 5th, 2025, and I'm here with Jim Fall, and we are interviewing Ron Stanek about the history of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game Subsistence Division and some of the early days and things that Ron and Jim worked on. So let's get us started. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, I was going to start, Ron, by just asking how you got with the division, how you found the job, who, and so forth. I don't know that story.
Okay, that's a good question. The real reason I think Tom Lawner hired me, I came up to Alaska after I finished my master's degree in Illinois at Western Illinois University in Parks and Recreation, and I did my specialty on woodpeckers. But anyway, my wife and I were married in East Africa. We came back. We went to graduate school. So we were looking for jobs in 1976 and 77 and 78. And so I had job offers around the United States at the Park Service. But here's one in Alaska with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Well, let's go to Alaska. What the heck? Okay. So I came up here and I worked for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for 2 years as a work program coordinator. And then Reagan came into office and he was going to cut out these programs, President Reagan. So I applied for different jobs with the state because the state was paying almost twice as much as the feds were at the time, right? Well, why not? And so I got this interview with Tom Lawner. Well, so when I graduated undergraduate school, I had my physical all taken to go to Vietnam or wherever I was going to go in the military. And then they started the drawdown in 1970-71. I graduated in 71. And so I got a letter saying, you know, we don't want to kill you in Vietnam, or we don't want you. So I got this kind of deferment thing, right? And so then, well, this was in the fall or winter of 70. And I was going to Colorado State. I was getting my degree in wildlife management. But somebody said, you know, there's, 11 or 12,000 jobs nationwide in wildlife management. And there's only about 4,000 or 5,000 graduates. Anyway, so they had a program in our anthropology department in East African Studies, and it was connected to the Peace Corps. So.
And that was undergraduate.
And that was when I was finishing my undergraduate degree in the spring of 71. And so I enrolled in that, and it was very interesting. And I didn't know if I was going to go to there, but by the end of it, I applied, and I got accepted to go to East Africa, to Kenya. But it was because of my farm experience, because I grew up on a farm. I, you know, grew up in northern Illinois on a farm. I was a farm kid. And so when I went to East Africa in the spring, summer of 71, got over there, and I was a Peace Corps volunteer. I did not end up in the ag program because they ended up having enough graduates in their college program in Kenya. So it turns out that the guy who was our director was the son of a professor at Michigan State University who was in the wildlife department. And he goes, you got a degree in wildlife management. I'm going to get you a job with the Park Service, with the Kenya Park Service. So I got a job as an education officer in the largest national park in Kenya, Tsavo East National Park. Anyway, I set up an education center there for 2 years. I was working for a man named David Sheldrick, who was a very famous game warden. Park set up this park from scratch. His wife is Daphne Sheldrick, who's passed away, but she did the orphans thing. Anyway, so then this woman I met in one of my ecology classes at CSU, Judy Gettles, she was finishing her education degree, and we were communicating. We had gone together for a while at college, and she came over there, and she liked it. And despite all the bugs, and so we were married in the park where I was working. Okay, so that was my Peace Corps experience. I did that for 2 years. Then I worked for the National Museums of Kenya for Richard Leakey for 2 years. We were working at one of the prehistoric sites, and we built exhibits at the museum talking about the environment. and we illustrated this site, Olerga Sally prehistoric site, which is an Acheulean hand axe site that's 253,000 years old. So we worked at the site out in the remote part of Kenya with Maasai people. They were all around us. But I had a staff of Kenyans working for me at the park and at the thing, and I learned the language there. Okay. So when I applied for that job with the state, Tom Largo's, man, you've worked with people in rural areas and you're not afraid to be out among people who aren't your race, because it's all black people, right? Where we worked in Kenya, that's all it was. There were some British people we worked for, and shelter was white, and our staff were white, but I had all these black, Africans. So that was what he said. You got it. Those are great qualifications. You'll probably like it. And I said, yeah, I probably would. Plus, I grew up hunting and fishing. That's what I did. My uncles and my dad hunted and fished, trapped. So I knew all that. That was part of my. Mm-hmm. And when I came up here and I worked for the Fish and Wildlife Service, I still have a lot of friends there, and we had hunted over to the Susitna Flats. I ended up getting a cabin over there with one of my Fish and Wildlife Service biologists. I still have the cabin. Hunted over there. I hunt moose over there and did all that. And at the same time, I was going to digress a little bit. That's when I met Steve Braun, because he was working. So anyway, I got a job at the Fish and Game office here. And Alice Stickney was already working there.
What month and year is this?
April.
April of 1980?
Yes, 1980, right. Yeah, April of 1980. And so Alice was there, and so things were going on about the case, I guess, at that time. And
the Tionic case.
The Tionic case, right. I think that was the main focus at the time. And so now trying to remember just how far we want to go with that.
And when you say the Tionic case, that was their claim for subsistence king salmon fishing in Cook Inlet that they'd been restricted from doing, and they were fighting it?
That's right, because they had probably, when you arrived, had the board meeting already occurred where they, where Tionic went to the board and asked for the fishery to be open? Because you were telling me yesterday that you were at that meeting.
Well, I was at, I don't know how many meetings they had to tell me.
Probably
that.
More
but
than
the way,
one.
But the one meeting I remember very distinctly was Bonnie McCord was the lead. She was, I don't remember her position in the village, but she was high up in the village. Bonnie, Fedora Constantine.
An elder.
I can't remember if Nellie Chickalusion was there. And I think Ray McCord was there, because that's mm-hmm. Bonnie's husband. Mm-hmm. And so they were over several times. And they were all lined up on the wall over on that side, and the board was over on the left, and there was Jim Beaton and Chris Gall and
Nick Szabo.
Nick Szabo. Those are the three. And there was this one native guy. I can't remember his name. He was from...
Jimmy Huntington.
Huntington, but there was another guy from Dillingham.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so there was this stuff going, this discussion going on, and the board members, several of them were very disrespectful of these women talking about their fishing and going on all this about what they were doing and why they wanted the fishery. And they just were just being dismissive of it and like almost not believing them and just being very impolite. And I think it was Bonnie started just crying. They just started weeping. And it was still so disturbing. And I mean, you say, well, that probably affected. Ellis was upset. I remember that now. And we went out with them to the outside later with the recess. And they were just like, what? Are you kidding me? So I don't know what happened after that, how that worked into settling who was going to get what.
Did you witness Alice's presentation
no,
to the board?
I don't remember it.
Okay.
I don't remember. I think she did, but I don't remember.
Because it could be that she did that after they went to the board first. That you were at that board meeting.
Sorry.
Where Tionic was asking for the fishery, and the board members must have backed off a little bit and said, subsistence section, we want you to go over there and talk to people and
collect
information.
Could be.
And I think that might have happened afterwards.
Could
and
be.
Then They must have had a follow-up meeting where Alice gave her a report, but you were not at that one.
Yeah, I don't remember that specific. So they were doing something already with the village because Alice and I went over there just to introduce me, and she didn't stay on very much longer after I was hired, and Dan Foster was hired. So Dan and I were, and so we went over there, and we met with Don Standifer, who was the village president at the time. And, you know, we went there, and we had talks with him. He's got to like us and showed us around, you know. And so what we were hoping or planning to do was to have some kind of way of counting the number of fish that people, that's what the board wanted to know. And Gary Sanders was the area biologist. Jim Browning was one of the biologists. So come up with a way of doing it. So what resulted from the need to get the information was a permit, a paper permit, and it had, you know, name, and it had the number of weeks or days of fishing that would be there, and they had come to that conclusion already. I think they only had the days up until, not the Saturdays, but anyway, they had the number of days. Mm-hmm. And so the council, we met with the village council, of course, and that was always the process in anything we did, was to meet with the councils. And so they agreed to do that, and yeah, they had no problem with that. But at some point, somehow, the lawsuit went, they got their fishery,
yeah.
And then it was a matter of coming up with how many fish, because there was this discussion about how much does each fish weigh, and how many pounds, or how many fish, and
mesh, and it was connected to mesh size.
Well, it was the deal with the mesh size, because how are we going? Are we going to go into this more like about that, or how are we
going to? Just keep going.
You're doing great.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, so that's how I got hired anyway, and so then we transitioned into this part of how we did it, right?
That was going to be my question, by the way, Ron, is what was your first assignment? And so you went right. You anticipated exactly what I
absolutely was going to ask, like, that's what you got to, the town, you got to go over there.
But so the question, though, is, you know, you have to figure out how to count the salmon, and you're talking about the size and the weight. That was subsistence division, or that's
so,
not the biologist?
So the commercial fisheries division had the authority to do this, but somehow, I don't know how that worked out with division leadership, but the subsistence division was given the responsibility, go to the village, meet with the people, and come up with a way of, you know, an amicable way of doing the work and going there.
Okay.
And so that worked out pretty good, because we got the permits, we made the permits, Dan and I. Because Alice never went over there with us to actually, I don't remember her going over there with us to issue the permits and actually go to the fish camps. Because once we got there and people would come to the community center, they had a small building community center at the time, and we would give out permits, and then people would say, well, aren't you going to come down to fish camp? Well, of course we're going to come down to fish camp. So that really worked out to be, because then what the commercial fisheries people wanted, and I can't remember if this was in the initial part of the fishery or later, that the commercial fisheries wanted scales in order to look at the ages of the fish, and then they wanted to be able to figure out where these fish were coming from and which streams they were in. And so we actually did collect the scales, and we had cards, and, you know, did that part, and went to the lab over at the Fish and Game office and so on, and then they dealt with that later on. But anyway, then, because we hit it off with them really well, we would go to people, stay at their fish camps, and they'd always have us in for tea and whatever holidays breads they were making, and a pot of fish chowder or moose meat or whatever. And then the commercial biologists started coming over as well, and they were out there on the beach, and there was Barb Bellringer was one of our technicians, and she went over there and worked with us as well. So there was like three subsistence people, and then occasionally the area biologist from Soldotna would come over and just see what was going on and meet the people, and it got along really well. I mean, it really did hit it. We hit it off great over there, I thought. So
how did you issue a permit? That was after you figured out how much people were taking, or
no, it was before. It was we had a paper with the name and address, and they got a number, and then on the bottom part of the page was just. I can't remember if it initially had the dates on it, but it had blanks, and it had five species of salmon on this columns, and then the dates over here, because they were open. I can't remember how many days that were open, Mondays, Thursdays, and Fridays, or Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays. I can't remember initially what it was, but they were open 3 days a week.
And they had a limit of how many fish they could get?
So, there was a household limit. Right, a household limit. But there was also eventually set a limit for the fishery. I think it was 4,200. I think it was something like that.
That is correct, yeah.
Yeah, 4,200 fish. Yeah. And then, but they had like 25 and 10 or something like that per household.
How do you come up with that number?
Well, that was what was going on with Don and the different fishermen over there. They were talking. They met with the board also. They actually came and discussed this kind of stuff with the board because I think board members, I think they were a little bit like, what are you going to do with 25 king salmon, you know, and 10 more for your household? And they didn't understand. The board members had no clue about what people over there would use and how much they would traditionally get. So at some point that was resolved by Tyonic people coming to the board and explaining, if I recall, talking about that, because I know Don was involved in that, and I think probably eventually the board was ready to listen to that kind of information from people in the village. I'm pretty sure that's the way that worked, because I don't remember. I and Dan didn't figure that out. The people there came up with that.
Yeah. If I could interject a couple things. One, as I'm understanding the sequence now, things moved pretty fast. It sounds like that you were hired, and it sounds like that Tyonic had already submitted this proposal, and that you attended that. It sounds like the first board meeting where there's a lot of skepticism, and either at the same time or right after that, the subsistence section then with Alice Stickney did the interviews, and they must have come back to the board. Alice must have given a report, and the board said no. The board said no, and Kionic went to court quickly, and it was a slam dunk.
Yeah.
Right.
It was an absolute slam dunk and it was the first test of the state subsistence law, because the court said, if you are allowing sport harvests on this stock, and you're not allowing subsistence harvest, you are breaking the subsistence law. If there's a harvestable surplus, you must provide for subsistence. But it was even more important than that, because what the fish board was claiming is that, well, why don't they just harvest sockeyes? You know, they want this. I even remember because I've listened to the tapes. They said, you know, you guys just want gourmet fish.
Yeah.
So we'll let you use. We'll let you take sockeyes, but we don't want you to take any kings. We're going to have those for the sport fishery. And the court said, no, these are stock-specific findings that people from Tyonic have told you, that kings are different. It's the timing. It's the quality of the fish. It's the products that they put up, all these things. And I'm pretty sure that the way they came up with the number is that it was Don, I think you're right, it's Don Stanifer.
Yeah.
And I think there were 60 families in Tyonic, and they said about 50 king salmon each family, 50 times 60 is 3,000. But then they negotiated about the mesh size, and the biologist did not want them taking too many females, big females.
Yeah, right.
And Tyonic said, well, you know what, we like the big fish, and if you're not going to let us catch the big fish, give us more of the smaller ones. So that's how they got to 4,200.
Right.
But I'm sorry, I'm taking up your time. But one other thing is that one of the reasons that there was the in-season monitoring of the fishery with Fish and Game actually present is that the sport interests in Cook Inlet and some board members were highly suspicious of this. It gets back to what Ron was saying. You know, why do you need 25 kids? Aren't you going to sell them? You know, and they didn't think that this was really legitimate, and they wanted somebody over there watching. Plus, the biological information, which was needed. They wanted that in-season monitoring to keep an eye out. And Tyonic said sure, because Tyonic knew there was nothing going on here.
Right.
Yeah. But what you're saying about the reason king salmon, so eventually, of course, you realize, and people from Tyonic are talking from a perspective of their hundreds of years of tradition of why they catch king salmon, because king salmon are the first salmon. They're not the first fish, but they're the first salmon. And they're, when you catch king salmon and you process it in the spring, there are no flies. The weather is good. You can hang it out because way back, I don't know, before Russian times or short during Russian times, they just dried stuff. You know, and I think when Russians came then they started smoking it. I don't know about, but you know, I have those pictures of at the mouth of the Chewit where all these fish heads are hanging up dryings and fish salmon are drying. It's clearly king salmon. So, but the king salmon are, it's, they're just made for that time to come and catch and make the strips. They split the fish and they have different ways of, we could talk about that later, but they have different ways of processing it that fit the way the environment is. So the other part of that is that because native people in Cook Inlet were closely tied to the commercial fisheries, once red salmon came on, red salmon was what they sold. That's how they made their cash. And that comes from the canneries and the fish traps that were over by Tyonic and all that going way back to the early 1900s. Red salmon was what you caught during the middle of the summer and you sold. So to this day, people won't go and get red salmon in Tyonic. They won't do it. Sam, I mean, I know people, Max, Chickalusion, he won't. He doesn't want red salmon. He wants king salmon. Although this year, I could tell you, is a different story. But
yes. Yeah, so the red salmon wasn't a subsistence fishery.
No, it wasn't.
Well, it was before the commercial developed. Right. They did put up sockeyes too.
And then silvers were the next ones that came along in the fall. That was the other one. And I don't remember ever talking about pinks.
I mean, if they
but
catch
yet,
one,
if you go to Port Graham, they know. Well, like man, I got to have pink salmon. Yeah. but Tyonic, you know, is very specific as to how these fish fit into the way the environment is and the way the timing is and the economy and so on and so forth. So, but king salmon was certainly the, but there was, I don't know if there was an allocation for reds and silvers or not in that whole thing.
There wasn't a seasonal limit. There was just a household limit of 25.
For kings.
For kings, there was also a fishery limit of 4,200 or but not for sockeyes.
No. So, but they did catch in the king salmon fishery because kings are early enough and they pretty much are just running on by themselves that there aren't, it's not mixed except for a certain kind of red salmon that comes at early on like that. So people might catch a few reds, but it wasn't any significant amount that they would be catching. It wasn't till the middle of June and then the end of June that the sockeye starts showing up and then they go for commercial fish. Because when I went there, I think there were like 26 commercial permits. So all these families had the commercial permits, and their, you know, their individuals had the permits, limited entry permits, and then their families all went down and fished at fish camps. They all had their sites that were there by tradition, not by shore fisheries leases, the usufruct rights that they had for fishing there for generations for each family. Everybody knew that by that rock is Pat Chewett's, or, you know, by that Beshta Bay place, there's the place where Bismarck's fished and Roberts. They all have their places, and everybody respected that way of, you know, fishing on the beach. It's all very, even to this day, it's right. like that, you know. So, I mean, it's like, all very highly structured, actually, within the community. So, yeah.
Well, it's interesting how that really was a partnership, that monitoring of the fishery,
yeah,
and how open Tyonek was. And in 1981, the monitoring continued, and that's the year that I was there, that I helped. I was on the beach and was helping Billy Pete and Shem Pete with their set net, and along came one of these monitors. And I didn't hear anybody complain either. I mean, Billy caught a lot of fish that day. He caught like 20 kings in one day, and he said, "Oh, you know those fish and game, they're gonna come and they're gonna count these. So I just have to wait here." So he lined them up, and along came Keith Webster.
Keith Webster, right, and
that's how I found out about the Division of Subsistence. And when you interview me, I'll tell you that. Story.
The monitors were not subsistence divisions.
Well, they were too. Yeah, but there were also some commercial fisheries people.
Okay. Yeah, there was a couple of people.
Yeah,
that went there,
and you asked why it was division of, or then subsistence section, and you know, an experience that I had, at least with some fish and game people, is that they were kind of afraid to go to native villages.
Well, and I don't know how long that. The fear factor existed, but there were events with Fish and Wildlife Protection and law enforcement going to the village and getting chased out or shot at or whatever, things that happen. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the white biologists, the white people who were running the Fish and Game Department, and they had no cross-cultural experience. They didn't, in their education, and I went to school in wildlife management. I know there was no talking about lower 48 native tribes and their, like it is today, mm-hmm. there was none of that. Mm-hmm. In our teachings, we didn't have anything to do with the Sioux Indians or the Arapaho or any of those people who were in Colorado. And what did they do with wildlife? How do they, you know, anything like that? It was when it came here that was like, well, you know, primarily the subsistence law based on what native people do, you know, or what have done. And that's how that whole thing is kind of based on that tradition mm-hmm. and stuff. So these people are not, I can understand their just reluctance or, I don't know, fear, whatever, to go to a community where they are a different color, you know, they're different people. Mm-hmm. And they're native people, and they're Indians, and whatever else kind of stereotypes.
Yeah.
That because, and like I got living in East Africa, it didn't bother me one bit. I never ever had any kind of thing like that. Yeah. You know, any kind of feeling of animosity toward any people.
Yeah. Well, and in the early days, it was game wardens who were enforcement, mm-hmm. and that's why they were not so welcome in some of the villages.
And actually, most fish and wildlife biologists in fish and game, they are deputized.
Oh,
yeah.
Even now they are, and it's a big mistake actually. But people know that, and that was something that the subsistence section of the division absolutely resisted.
Was not, yeah.
There was no way that we could have enforcement authority of any sort, because we wouldn't have learned anything.
Right.
No. Well, and if you would have followed your commitment. Even if biologists come in and people in the village don't know that the biologist has a badge or that they are, you know, supposed to enforce whatever laws that some might be violated or whatever, but people wouldn't have known that. I mean, it wasn't like those biologists said, "Hey, I'm a deputized," but it was fish and game.
Right.
Yeah. So there's always that stigma or that stereotype it's just because it was fish and game biologists or personnel who did it, or it was the state trooper wildlife enforcement people who are fish and game also.
Right, and before Stater, it would have been fish and wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there are enough cases, the Barrow Duck Inn, the waterfowl and the Kuskokwim, mm-hmm. all those
right.
migratory mm-hmm. birds, you know, all those cases that, right. you know, mm-hmm. the native communities knew about. And
right.
So
right.
I could see that they
yeah.
were reluctant. But so it's interesting that though when you went in subsistence, you were welcomed.
Right.
Which is different.
And but they didn't know, they asked, you know, and because we were explaining the rules and the laws all the time, and they're going, well, you're going, and I remember, you're going to arrest us for this or that, and no, I don't, I'm not going to arrest you. I didn't say, well, I don't have a badge. I just said, I'm not going to arrest you. Yeah. No, we're just here to do this, to help find out what's going on and to document what you do, because that's important, that
mm-hmm.
because you know, see what's happened here with people questioning your right to have this resource, have access and harvest it in a kind of special way. You know, we're here to put that down on paper and show so you can defend yourself.
Yeah, that's what I wondered, if they felt heard and, you know, listened to for the first time, and that here was somebody who was listening to them,
right.
and advocating for them,
sure,
their
sure.
way of life.
Absolutely.
I think that's correct.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. And I mean, you know, they understood that, even though we might not have understood the long-term effect of it, but I think they knew that, especially Bonnie, and Bonnie McCory. I mean, she was astute and knew that what this was about, you know, this about rights, they're
yeah.
and about their traditions, and they really have this,
mm-hmm.
that they should, you know, that there should be their right, but we got to defend this somehow, and having the information was that eventually was certainly played out.
There were stories that some elders said, told us, that despite the closure, there was some fishing that went over there, and people would dodge for cover if a plane flew over, and so there was still this hesitancy or apprehension about things. But
here's the reality of why that happens. The way the fishery is set up, there were times of the day. So, for example, I remember what it was initially, but at least it went from like 4 o'clock in the morning until 8 o'clock at night. Well, you know about tides, right? The tides don't go by
the clock.
Tides go by
the moon,
the way things the way the earth and the
yeah,
planets
right.
and everything. So the best time for fishing is on the flood, when the tide's coming in, and on certain tides that are higher or lower.
Mm-hmm.
So there are ideal times for setting your net and fishing. And so that's why you might miss a tide or the best tide during that day, and it happens after the closure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're going to go out there and set a net and catch it, because that's when you would have done it anyway.
Yeah.
You know, and we tried to get the timing set that said mm-hmm. that it could be according to the, but the law enforcement
mm-hmm.
and commercial fisheries, I didn't want that, because it's inconvenient to be able to manage a fishery or manage anything when it's just so random like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why that, and to this day they do that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's no question. I mean, I can tell you people who will tell you, well, I'm going to catch my fish. I'm just going to get my fish, and that's all. And I don't care what the, but. You know, and they'll record it and they put it down
yeah.
or not.
Yeah.
But
so there's no effect on the fishery
right.
on the run.
No, it doesn't.
Right.
No,
yeah.
it's not going to affect. It's yeah. only an administrative convenience
yeah.
that those
mm-hmm.
times there are there, and so that's why it happens.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
and they're they know how to go about it so that
mm-hmm.
they avoid
yeah.
not out there blatantly doing it. Although some people have been. Chastised, some people in the village have been chastised for doing it at certain times or whatever. If somebody else, if everybody else isn't getting a chance or something, they might be criticized for it, but usually not. It's because you have to do that in order to get the fish. So,
and that's all understanding what the subsistence lifestyle is about. And so eventually the board came to, well, I would say the board came to understand this subsistence lifestyle in Tyonek, but it's because they were sued, I guess.
Well, let's move on to that, because, you know, in terms of Tyonek, it was 81 that I was over there and the monitoring was still going on. I don't know whether it went into 82 or not, but after a few years, everybody realized there was no reason to monitor it that like that, because nobody was selling fish. There was,
right.
And people were obeying the law. We got 95% of the permits came back, and they'd fill it out. They'd put it on their wall, and it would be covered in fish blood. Now you get the permit back, and it was fun. And I think the leadership in Tyonek and most of the people there, they were proud that they had tested the law. They're proud people, but they also realized that they needed to basically put up they needed to behave, you know.
Right.
They supported that because they wanted the fishery to continue, and they wanted the run to continue.
But go
ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you said proud. Well, they are very proud of the way they do. When we started showing interest and respect and eating their food and going there and staying with them and just being there around and them accepting us, they are proud of what they do. They're proud people. And so, yeah, this is what we do. This is the way we live. And by golly, this is what we've been doing for a long time in our families. And so, yeah.
And there's a certain surprise when you actually eat the beluga fat.
Well, when you eat beluga fat or you eat fish heads, you know, king salmon heads or however they make it, saltfish, and you just learn about all the ways, all the different ways that they, and they're happy to show you how they, this is like, hey, let me show you how, I mean, so they're proud of what they do, and they have no reason to be, shy about.
Yeah, and that was one of the real issues that I know Nellie would tell me this, and Fedora too, is that if they did fish or they had fish and the season was closed, and they had to sort of hide. This was awful because they had to hide what they were proud of. But actually, engaging in that in the full way of life over there and appreciating it is something that I think the division itself really tried to promote. And it's not as if other divisions staffs don't do that, because plenty of staff in the other divisions would also, especially in the more rural areas, maybe not so much in Cook. And what I was going to move into is that Tyonek was one of the first tests in Cook Inlet, but then the board moved into a broader review of Cook Inlet subsistence regulations. So how were you involved in that, Ron?
Well, I don't remember how the fisheries in Port Graham, in that sub-district those two communities, plus Saldovia, but primarily Port Graham and Nanwalek, or English Bay at the time, as it was called, I don't remember how that subsistence fishery was established, but Alice and I went down there and went to both of those communities and started, learning about, got introduced, learning about what they were doing. So at some point, the fishery had to be monitored there too. But it was a while before I think the rules were set up. I can't remember how that happened. I think you were on when that started.
This is before me. And I think what happened, and I don't know the actual sequence, but Tyonek sort of led the way. And then the board did develop the criteria, the 8 criteria or the 10 criteria to identify customary and traditional uses in Cook Inlet.
Then applied that.
And Tyonek, Nanwalek, and Port Graham were the only ones that sort of passed the test.
Right.
Yeah. And so it was Alice already been to
yeah, oh yeah.
So she had been to Nanwalek and
Oh
Port
yeah,
Graham.
Oh yeah. Oh, she
wow.
took me down there and
oh,
we,
wow.
oh yeah, same kind of thing. Sub process. So we went down there and went around and met, the Kabaznikovs and
the Tanapis. The
Tanapis and all the Moonans and all the rest of them in both Port Graham and Nanwalek. So, I mean, but yeah, the same kind of process played out down there. We met with the councils and what are we going to do or why are we doing it and the whole thing. And they, yeah, well, what are you going to do? How are you going to do that? Permits? And I can't remember how it came up with the calendar, but they had a permit initially. And then eventually it got, they had some kind of permit. And then, and so we would issue them at the council office, or I can't remember how this happened, but somehow I started going around to every household. And that was just like, they bought into that. Because you got to go, they're going to have tea, and you're going to have whatever they have come in and give me the permit, or they want they're waiting for you to come around to get. That was what it was. It's like people invited us to come over, and you know, and just have tea, chai. You know, you're going to have chai. So we're having chai here. We had chai in East Africa. We had chai everywhere we went around the world. But we had chai here at our villages in Port Graham and Nanwalek and Tyonek as well. But people welcomed us to come, and I used to do that. I'd go to every household, and you know, I knew everybody. I know their kids, and to this day, I still interact with people in all these villages, you know. But anyway, so there's other little lateral things here to talk about, but if we keep going on the... But Port Graham and Nanwalek, and we came up with a calendar system because we were looking at more than just the salmon, right? Mm-hmm. Came up with a calendar, so I developed a pictorial thing with halibut and plants and clams and all this stuff. And so we had this calendar device that, I don't know, what are they doing down there now?
I'm not sure, but I don't think that, I think it's a permit system, and I don't think it works very well anymore.
Well, anyway, came up with a calendar, which people just loved, because we had color and put it on their walls, and we had the months of the year when we were doing that, and go there, and I'd go there once a month or so during the summer months, and wow, it was really...
Well, I find it interesting that the subsistence staff were issuing the permits.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. No, we had authority to do that, and we did it in Bristol Bay. We still do Bristol Bay. We did Chignik for a while. We did some other places.
Yeah, still do it in Tyonek.
To Tyonek, we do. Yeah. We still do.
I didn't realize that was part of the subsistence staff duties. I was thinking you were doing interviews with people and collecting harvest data and things
like that. One of the charges in the original law, and it still exists, is to estimate subsistence harvest, to quantify it. So the permit comes under that. Okay. I think some people in the department, more so in wildlife probably than in comfish or sportfish, would say that technically it's their authority that they grant to us.
And I thought it was just delegated. I mean, I don't know what the word is, but delegated that the Commercial Fisheries Division kind of delegated it to the supervisor, regional supervisors, subsistence, and then
they did pay for it for a while too.
Yeah, they did. Right, right. So, that's right.
But I was going to say, you know, Tyonek was kind of on its own. It got support from the Alaska Legal Services, but Nanwalek and Port Graham, they were part of a regional organization that back then was called the North Pacific Rim. Later on was Chugachmute. And they had staff. It was Lee Stratton was staff.
Right.
And
right.
I think it was maybe Lee or somebody else there that negotiated the change in regulations for Nanwalek and Port Graham. Because they didn't have to go to court to get an appropriate fishery.
When did Lee Stratton come on to our... work for the division?
She started a few months before I did, and I started in September of 81, and she was pretty new.
Yeah.
She might have been there for like 3 or 4 or 5 months. Denny Kelso was after to hire her, right, you know, for a long time.
I see.
Yeah.
Well, and she didn't just work around this area. She worked in the Prince William Sound area.
Tidlick, Chenega Bay, Valdez, Cordova.
Right, right. So we kind of got the areas divided up among the staff, you know, different... communities for different.
Right. Yeah. Do you remember how that got divided up, or
I don't remember,
or how you got assigned to do Nunwalloc and Port Graham?
It was here in Cook Inlet, yeah. and those three villages were
originally. It was anticipated that we'd have a staff person in Glen Allen. And
right.
And then Lee Stratton was offered the job. She had a lot of experience, but she didn't want to move out there. And so the compromise was that she could stay in Anchorage, but spend a lot of time out in the Copper Basin.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then so I think that's when did Susan Georgette get that assignment?
Susan Georgette was hired to be an assistant to Kerry Reed to work on the urban-rural project.
But Susan Georgette, didn't she... She had the Copper Basin for
afterwards,
a while.
Afterwards, after Carrie left.
Oh, I see.
She became
that's right,
Lee's assistant.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah. But another thing, maybe you could comment on this a little bit, because we were saying how the appreciation of the subsistence way of life was developing. Did you see that develop within the department, or...
Within the department?
Yeah. Yeah. Did you see any like changes or?
Well, other than, I think, people, biologists like Jim Farrow and Gary Sanders, who was the area biologist in Kenai or Soldotna, because the Soldotna office was the ones that were managing the different fisheries in Cook Inlet. But Gary Sanders and Jim Browning, once they went over to Tionic, they were like, yeah, and people really liked it and invited them to come. I remember they said, well, you can come over anytime. I remember that, standing on the beach talking to people. And so those biologists, I think Sanders bought into it and was more receptive of it than others, because I think when he went to Juneau, because he eventually got higher up in Sportfish, mm-hmm. and he was more of an advocate for subsistence, if I remember hearing stories about him, mm-hmm. and because some of the biologists didn't like his way of him liking subsistence. I remember that somehow. But anyway, they really, once they went there and learned what it was about, they had no problem with it. And then when we started coming back with the samples and stuff, of the scale samples and the counts and that, then... And like Keith Webster, he went over there and he was a...
he was comm fish and then he became sport fish.
Yeah, that's right, because I couldn't remember what. Eventually he died of leukemia. But anyway, he would go there and he knew people. And so that's how I remember them becoming... And then the same thing with the wildlife biologist, Jim Farrow, was one who... He would go over there and take Tionic people, because then as they became more involved in the board process, having their own advisory committee, and I don't remember when they started having an advisory committee in Tionic or Port Graham, but I can remember at the very beginnings of that and the way we were trying to get them to participate. But once they were going to they came and went to the board meetings, then they met the biologists there also. And Jim Farrell, well, he was a wildlife biologist for Unit 16. And he would go over there, and there were some studies going on with the coal, potential coal mining. And then so they were monitoring where the moose migrated over on the west side. And so Jim Farrell was flying. So he'd stop in the village and pick up Peter Merriman and take him flying around and look for moose. And so he really got into it. Jim really got into it. And Herman Grisset did for a while, but then some of the other wildlife biologists, they wouldn't even go over there. And some of the sport fish biologists, by and large, wouldn't just go over there. Ones that were stationed in Palmer, I don't remember how they switched that around. But anyway, some of them would go, some of them wouldn't. And the same with wildlife protection. There was this one native guy who was a wildlife protection officer. And he was here in Anchorage, and he would go to the village, and he was welcomed over there. Yeah, I can't remember his name. His wife and grandkids were killed in a motor accident at Tudor and Lake Otis. They were killed there during the time. But anyway, and then there were troopers like... I can't remember his name now, but he was a trooper out here. He he would go over there. He was another native guy who would go over there. And then after I can't remember that guy's name now, because he used to go out on the Susitna here. I'll tell you about some of these collateral things that happened since when I was working for the division. But the troopers just kind of, it just depended on the person, I think, and whether they somehow made an inroad in the village or talked. But some of them were welcome and some of them weren't. And I'd even flown with some of these, a couple of the troopers over there looking at other people who were, like Dennis Torrey, looking at his operation up in the hills, because he was doing illegal stuff, right? And so I knew about it because I had been there, and so somehow I got connected with one of the troopers, and he took me over, and we were flying around talking about it. And he was welcome in the village as well. So it just depends. And by the way, sometimes people in the village would ask the troopers, they actually wanted, you know, Steve Evans, he was a, was he VPSO? He became a trooper as well, and he was stationed in Beluga, I think. Yeah. And, you know, he was, I don't know about welcome, but he interacted with the village, and he was married into the village. So some of them, and sometimes people, they wanted troopers to come over there because there were people doing nasty things. When KLM, Kodiak Lumber Mills, was harvesting the timber down off on the Trading Bay Flats, there was a huge timber sale down there, and they had set up a chip mill at what's called, that's the North Forelands, Granite Point, then the North Forelands. So there's a chip mill there. There's a dock that Tyonic Native Corporation built, and then there was a chip mill, and then these chips were chipped up there and then put on these big vessels that came and loaded them and took them wherever they were going. So the people who were the workers for the lumber company, they were doing illegal things harvesting moose. And the Tyonic people wanted troopers to come over and get them. There was this one guy who was particularly bad about, they would go out and they would kill these moose, and then they'd go with their front end loaders and pick them up and bring them back to the lumber. And that guy was killing a bunch of moose himself. And so people were really upset about that. So that was an instance where they were inviting the troopers to come over and do it. And the other thing was that down on the south of Tyonic, on these flats, the Trading Bay Flats, where Tyonic people have traditionally hunted waterfowl and moose for as long as moose have been around and going down there. It's not been forever, but for a long time. So people from across the inlet from Soldotna, they would come with their boats, and they would bring their three-wheelers at the time and drive around and kill moose, and then they would fly over with their airplanes and spot moose, and then it was illegal to use radios, but we had walkie-talkies back then. And so there was this interaction going on between the airplanes and people on the ground. And so they were upset about that because, you know, they might be down at MacArthur River, which was one of the main places they like to go. Tyonic people go down. It's a few hour boat ride. But MacArthur River is like, that's Mecca for moose hunting. You know, that's mm-hmm. where you go. They all had camps down there, or they went down there and camped on the beach. Mm-hmm. And here are these airplanes flying over, and then other people coming and getting in on that whole thing. Mm-hmm. So, and in some instances they could land their airplanes, but that caused a lot of grief. And so they wanted troopers to come over. So they were inviting troopers and calling troopers. It still goes on to this day.
So you can see how that work regarding the fish just started to expand. But you're talking about moose, and it reminds me then that Tyonic was part of an effort to change the subsistence moose hunting seasons. But what I wanted to ask you about is that you didn't just work in Native communities. You worked in some non-Native communities too, and had worked in connection with that moose effort. So maybe you could talk a little bit about
it. I don't remember how that was. Was it a proposal that came to the board for a winter moose hunt?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was by people in Unit 16, people who live in the farthest parts of Unit 16B, I don't remember how 16A was interacting in that.
This is the Western Sioux Sydney area, yeah. And it's almost entirely non-native people who had homesteaded.
People in the Lake Creek, Alexander Creek, Lake Creek, Alexander Creek, Yentna River, Squintna River, Kashwitna, drainages, all those drainages from as far north as, what, not quite Talkeetna. Well, it's, you know, it extends up that way, but not on that, on the road
Creek,
side,
yeah.
But on the road system, yeah. But off the road system, what's called, it's everything that's kind of west of the, I think, the Kashwitna?
The Kahiltna. Yeah.
West and in the mountains. Everything you can see is Unit 16.
Yeah.
When you look over there, that's what you see. Well, those people who, many of whom were trappers from the 20s and 30s,
mm-hmm.
had come here to Anchorage with the railroad and had gotten asbestosis and were told, no, you got to get out of here. So a lot of them moved over there. A number of them moved over there. The Rosses, for example, Vernon Ross and them, they moved over. And they moved up. And Schellebarger, Max Schellebarger.
Later Joe Delia, if you've heard
Joe
Delia. From, yeah.
Joe Delia, I don't remember how he got up there. I don't think he was connected with the railroad, but he went up there. To Squintna, and the Schellebargers were there, and he became a guide and guided with Max Schellebarger when Joe was real young. But these people were living out in those remote places all the way up the. They weren't living as far as Happy River, but they were living on the Talachulitna, and then up the Yentna to Youngstown Bend is about as far as you can go on the Yentna. And there were trappers up there, old time people, and on the Kahiltna. So they were looking. So that's what Dan and I went over there and spent the winter, a couple winter and summer, going over there to all these places on our sewing machines in the winter and traveled all around. Stayed at Squintna, at the school building, and we went to all these households.
And what were you doing when you went to these households?
We had an interview, a questionnaire that we filled out that was asking questions about what they did. About their resources that they harvested, just like all the other.
So it's really different than Tyonek or Nanwalkapork Grand, where you have a community that's concentrated and has a long, continuous history of the same people. And here we had a rural population that was almost entirely non-native, that was spread out, and they. Needed to take moose as part of their way of life, but the issue, and this was an issue for Tyonek too, is that the most accessible moose were in the wintertime.
Yeah, and that's when they could preserve the meat, because back then, right, so they didn't all have refrigerators and freezers and generators to run, so they would get their meat in October, November, whenever it starts freezing up, and then they get their moose meat and hang it up, and so that's why they wanted to have that winter moose hunt. And that's what Tyonek had been doing. They get moose in the wintertime, and because if you got it in this time of the year, season opens now, you know, although it's much warmer these days perhaps, but that's a whole other issue, but you would have to dry it if you were going to get it now, dry it or salt it and smoke it and have a way of storing it without freezing it. Today, everybody has.
So this was a proposal from those hunters, or
I think it was the advisory committees that actually submitted the proposal, and I'm pretty sure it was the Squintna Advisory Committee, whatever that was called, Mount Yenlo Advisory Committee, and Tyonek joined in.
Uh-huh.
Tyonek had an advisory committee too.
Right.
I don't think they submitted it, but they totally supported opening a winter season.
And so the Board of Game said, before we can decide that, we need some proof or some evidence. So the Subsistence Division staff was sent out there to collect information.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
okay.
This is where the 8 criteria come in that have been developed specifically for fisheries, but then the Joint Board had adopted those criteria to identify customary traditional uses. So here was a population that was in some ways quite different from Tyonek.
Absolutely.
And it raised issues at the game board and the fish board too. The fish board fumbled it a lot worse than the game board did. But we needed to develop this idea that, you know, there's just not one way to understand subsistence here, and there's just not one kind of community that's involved either.
And at the time, didn't the rural priority play into that somehow? How was the rural priority playing into the whole thing at the time? Because Tyonek could get the subsistence fishing permits, but people in Anchorage could not. And that changed after the rural priority went away, right? But I can't remember if the game, wildlife game part of it was...
Well, it did. The way it worked is that not only was it rural, but they actually identified the communities that were associated with the traditional uses.
Right.
So the issue became, does this dispersed non-native population in the Western Susitna, does it have a time depth? Does it meet the 8 criteria? And what made a difference, and Ron did this work, is that there had been some continuity between the earliest non-native settlers there and the last native people who were Susitna station people who were then living in Tyonek. And there were people in Tyonek who remembered going up there, Nellie and Fedora. Huh. They had camped up there and they knew the Shellebargers and everything. So, but it was Ron's research
and Dan
Foster too, that showed that history that as being continuous. Plus they documented the range of resources being used. They documented the local nature of the activities, and of course all the trapping traditions.
Like he's saying that continuity was, there was this woman named Catherine Nikolai who was a trapper at Susitna Station, and one of the guys, Kenny Sorensen, who fished commercially in Cook Inlet down on Calgon Island. He fished by the mouth of the Sioux as well. He bought his permit, his trap line, not a permit, but a trap line from Catherine Nikolai, and she's a famous Tenaya elder, you know, who you know was around when we were working over there. And then there were these people, native people at Alexander Creek, who, you know, had a history, and we interacted with people there who, you know, knew all these people, interacted with them. They weren't necessarily relatives, but like the Thiels, who were from, well, are they from Bethel? The woman was from Bethel.
They were actually Yupiks.
Yeah, but they moved over there, and they knew all these people from Crow Dough Creek and Alexander Creek and Tyonek. You know, it's really interesting because, boy, there were... Yeah, well, when I started working at Beluga, there's a whole nother element of the history there that is just very deep, and it involves people from Alexander Creek going down there and fishing with the Kalowas. Boy, when you learn about the Kalowas and all the stuff that Albert Kalowa and...
This is a Tyonek family.
Agnes and, I mean, all these people on that Beluga side and the people who used to come down from Alexander Creek in their dories and go down and fish at Beluga with Helen Kurtz and the Kalowas and all these people, the bronze, there's a lot of people. I mean, there's so much interesting stuff over there, and there's still some of their buildings and dories that are over there, like at Helen Kurtz's place. So anyway, the Susitna people had this real, because a lot of these people I was telling you about moved from Anchorage in the 20s and 30s and 40s over to that area. They would come down, if they lived upriver, like Kenny Sorensen, they loaded their dories in the spring, and they came down river, and they were fishing out on the flats, on the Susitna flats, because that was, I fished over there anyway, and Calgon Island. So they came down and they fished, and they had camps over there. There were, I mean, it used to be a lot more structured for transportation and the way traffic moved here in the inlet early on in the 20s and 30s, because the Alaska Road Commission. There were no roads going up there, right?
Right.
So the Alaska Road Commission had a had ferries, or not they, not that they had them, but there were ferries, and the Alaska Road Commission had this network of cabins along the Susitna, at the mouth of the Susitna, along the Susitna, going to Susitna Station, going to up to where the Yentna branches off. So there was a whole thing going on, moving from Anchorage up that up the Susitna to get to the gold fields,
right,
to get to the Cache Creek, up mm-hmm. into the gold fields. And that's how a lot of that kind of got, that area got settled, mm-hmm. not on the what was the, eventually the railroad and a road there, you know. It was all that way.
Right. But I so mean, this work you did up there for this moose hunt, you were just determining a customary and traditional use.
Determining what they did, and then it could be determined whether it was customary.
Yeah, we wouldn't make the determination, but it was our job to collect the information to give to the board, along with testimony from people themselves that they could then apply. But one of the points here is that the back then, maybe a lot more, maybe more so than now, you know, one of the accusations against the division or the section was that, you know, we were only working with Native people weren't more broadly interested in subsistence uses by other Alaska populations, and this is a good example of where that's totally false.
Right.
It was different, and it was a challenge for the for both boards to see that the Native model wasn't necessarily the only model to follow here, but they needed information.
Yeah. And the people up there were just as welcoming as people in the village. We knew everybody. We were good friends with, Dan made friends with a lot of people up there, and like the teachers at the school, Bitney's, all these people we met, and I hear about their children today, you know, some of the Thiel's kids, and I met, you know, I mean, it's just, there's so many stories you could talk about here, but I think one of the other things that we kind of, there are these collateral things that happened. So when I met Steve Braun, and I was still working in the village in Tyonek and learning about how they fished and that, and Steve had this assignment to develop, a timeline or something of of so-called subsistence fishing in Cook Inlet and the rules.
Yeah.
And so we did that, but we had this, we had an assignment to go, we decided we're going to go down to the Kenai and we're going to set our net and we're going to go fishing.
Subsistence fishing.
So yeah. So we go with Steve's AMC Hornet and we go to Captain Cook State Park, right? We go to the beach and we drive up the beach to what's called Birch Hills Moose Point. And we get up there. Well, it's just Boulder Field, you know. So we're like, wow, we're going to fish here. Anyway, so Steve really hadn't gotten into fishing yet. But we did. We went up there and we drove on the beach. You can do it to this day. You can take your reasonable vehicle, and drive up there. And we did. And we fished. And we learned about how it could be done. But at that time, subsistence fishing was open inlet wide. You could go from Anchorage to Point McKenzie if you got your subsistence permit and set a net right there. And so one of the other things. So all along Cook Inlet above the Forelands? It was south also on the, so the west side of the Cook Inlet. I think it was everything north of Inilchik, so everything in the central district and northern district was open to subsistence fishing. So
didn't have to be a local resident.
Nope. You could get a permit. And so what I used to do is I got in an airplane and it would fly from Anchorage, fly down the inlet all the way and go across the inlet and count nets on the beach on those days that were open. And John Gisberg and I did that one time.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't
Gisberg
know that.
Went along with that.
He was an attorney for the state. Yeah.
He was like, what? Because I don't remember why he did that, but I think it was like to believe it or to see it or whatever.
Because anyway. They were debating what was subsistence in Cook Inlet. That's why he wanted to see it.
Yeah. So I used to do that. So I used to fly down the inlet on the and look at the beach, you know, count on the days when it was supposed to be open. And so that's another thing I did that was like, wow, I think about that. Well, for whatever reasons, that went away. And I thought it was mostly because the managers didn't like having to deal with that kind of issue. I couldn't remember why. And I think Delaney was really against that kind of thing, Kevin Delaney, but I can't remember why it went away.
Well, Steve Braun addresses that in the report that he did for the division.
Okay.
And the number of permits, subsistence permits, are actually issued for Cook Inlet for decades was minuscule.
Right.
And then in 78, the state passed a subsistence law, and there was publicity about it. And so the number of permits, subsistence permits, issued for Cook Inlet, quote unquote, skyrocketed. You know, and it went from like 50 or 60 to 500 or 600. And so people were pulling out their hair. My God, this is a priority fishery, and it's going to just knock out everybody else. And Braun talks about that.
Okay.
But it was this fear. And actually, Lahner talks about it too in some of his writing. That as soon as subsistence got any kind of attention, people, managers were worried that it was going to just go out of control and just wipe out the sport fishery, wipe out the commercial fishery. And so the Fish Board made these findings that the only legitimate subsistence uses in Cook Inlet were Tyonic, Port Graham, and on Wallach, and the result of that was what became the Madison case.
Oh, that's right.
And an early finding in that, because what the Fish Board did, like Ron said, is that not only did it say that most of these fisheries on the east side of Cook Inlet, and even on the west side, other than Tyonic, that they weren't customary and traditional, they didn't adopt any other kind of opportunity for non-commercial fishing. They just closed it.
Yeah.
Right.
And the court said, well, doing the C&T thing is legitimate. You can do that, but you can't just wipe out these established uses. And that's where the personal use category was invented. And so that's what replaced.
But it didn't just continue to allow people to take a net and go anywhere.
No.
They put them all on the Kenai River.
And with dip nets.
Well, they had
with some nets. Exceptions.
They had set nets there for a while, but then they moved they closed the Kenai around the Kenai mouth to set nets, and then
the Kasiloff. Yeah,
so now you can set a net by Kasiloff and dip net and Kasiloff. So now you've got hundreds of thousands of people that go down there and catch hundreds of thousands of sockeyes, which is just as well, because the Kenai River has got 5 million escapement this year. Yeah. And anyway, but I was going to say about Steve Braun. So because Steve and I were working together like that, and Steve, I'm not exactly sure how he decided to do this, but he bought a permit, a set net permit for Cook Inlet. I mean, talk about tradition. Steve, at least Steve, and in a number of other people living in Anchorage, used to set their nets on the beach out here at Bootlegger's Cove, because Steve did it. His family did it. That's how they caught fish. So they did do this, so they would have had there would have been a legitimate way of saying, well, we've been doing this for, I don't know, how many generations of families, you know, around. And Dick Catherwood and people who lived right here on Campbell Creek used to catch their kings right here. Mm-hmm. He lived right down, he's dead now, but he used to live. And he used to catch his king salmon right here, because before they put the dam in Campbell Creek. So there were a lot of non-native people and native people in Anchorage. You look at all the native people who fished down at Ship Creek. That was their traditional place.
Yeah, Point Warren's off.
Yeah, Point Warren's off and catching king salmon, you know, and up along Kinnick Arm. I mean, there was a lot of tradition as far as that goes, but how are you going to deal with a couple hundred thousand people and putting that?
Right.
But anyway,
that became the issue.
So what I was going to say is that when Steve started to set up, he bought a site over on Fire Island from the Theodores, from one of the Theodores.
It's a native family from Kinnick.
Yeah, from Kinnick. Those people who lived in Kinnick, and they had a tradition. They would go to Fire Island and fish. So Steve wasn't sure how to set up a running line, so I went over there and helped him and started fishing with him over there and set that operation up. And he still to this day has this beautiful place, and he's got lots of beach where he fishes and that. But so, okay, so that was in the early 80s. And then I bought a permit. And my wife and I set up our commercial fishing operation. We bought a permit from a school teacher who was fishing by the mouth of the Susitna, this side of the mouth of the Susitna, along with the Reddingtons and a bunch of other people who were old-time, you know, Cook Inlet, living in Kinnick and Anchorage. There's a lot of people who had set net operations out here, lived in Anchorage and Kinnick. And so I bought a site from Ramey Reddington, and I got a permit. And so that was in 1985 when I started doing that. So I fished there up until 1987. But what I wanted to, the reason I went, told you this story is that when I was fishing over there, my wife and I had a camp we set up at near the mouth of the Susitna. It was, at the time, you could go up and down at the mouth of the Susitna almost any time except when the tide was way out. The way the river flowed, it has a channel on the east side. There were two channels. There's an east side channel and a west side channel. Anyway, this place where we had a fish camp were the Reddingtons, Dave Olson. There's three Reddington families there, Dave Olson. And there was a native guy named Percy Blatchford. And he had a camp there, a big cabin. His family had been going there for a long time. And his main thing was beluga hunting and seal hunting, because back in then you could hunt belugas. But he had nets and he fished for subsistence. But I met him because we were right there. He invited us down, have coffee or whatever. And then I'd be fishing and he might be going by and come by and stop and get some fish from me and whatever. So I got to be really good friends with this guy. And so then, you know, he would get a beluga and bring it into the slough by our camps, and they would butcher it there, and they had meat racks, and they would flense the blubber and skin off, take that home, mostly that's what they took, and then they dry the meat on these racks over there. And so that was going on. And so then I said, I remember how we started this, but at some point we decided somehow to document this. And so I went down to the National Marine Fisheries Service, and this guy, Ron
Morris.
Morris.
That's right, yeah.
He didn't believe me. He goes, what? Sorry, I got a problem with that. So he didn't believe me, and I said, yeah, people are going from here, and they go out there, and they hunt belugas and seals and... How did you know Ron Morris?
I didn't, but I know the name.
Well, anyway, that's true. And so I went there, and so then somehow we ended up with a project to monitor the beluga harvest. So I got to know all these native hunters, and Percy was, you know, one of the guys who was very well-liked by all these people. He had been in the military, he'd been in like something like Special Forces, and he was a very well-known guy in the military here in Alaska, and so he had that whole career.
So this was the subsistence division got involved in documenting the
beluga harvest.
Yeah, and it was mostly by native people living in Anchorage,
right.
Yeah. And they were not Dena'inas. These were mostly Yupik and Inupiat people who had relocated to an urban center, but under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, were legally allowed to hunt belugas in Cook Inlet.
Right.
Now, Tionic took a few, too.
Right.
But most of the belugas being taken and that Ron learned about were by this urbanized population.
And was it a question that the beluga population numbers were...
Well, that's
at
where
at that
going.
Point, yeah. So I don't know, we're going to go into that. It's another whole other story, okay?
Yeah.
So I wrote a couple of papers about it, and that's where it went. Eventually, we had this... We tried to set up this agreement with the native hunters that they would participate in this But there were these two groups. It was like the good guys and the bad guys. There were the crooks, and there were ones who
It was becoming commercialized.
Right. And so anyway, we had a contract with NIMFS, National Marine Fisheries Service, to do this work. And those bad guys were voice different, and they didn't like it. So we just said, okay, we're not going to do this anymore. And the National Marine Fisheries Service set up an agreement with them, with the Cook Inlet, it established the Cook Inlet Marine Mammal Council. So then the hunters had their little groups, and they, okay, now that's going on a whole other can of worms. Yeah. And but that's how we got involved in monitoring beluga and getting involved with belugas, not the seal part. That's a whole other different thing. Seals and sea lions and another thing, but at least with the belugas in Cook Inlet. Yeah. Recently, we just rewrote the data that I collected. It's been 3 years ago. The Kathy Frost, Barb Mahoney, Kim Sheldon, Gregor Corey Crow, and I wrote another paper, and we reanalyzed the data, expanded it, in other words. And it's out there on the National Marine Fisheries Service website.
Hopefully, it's still there.
And we have these maps, and it's so you and I know kind of how that whole thing with the National Marine Fisheries Service went, right? So that's a whole nother story.
Did the data that you collected influence the establishment or discontinuation of a subsistence hunt?
No, it didn't. It didn't. But what happened after National Fisheries Service contracted with this group of native people, and luckily we weren't involved, they over-harvested the numbers, the belugas. Mm-hmm. The way that group handled the money and the whole thing, they went out there and just...
It really did become commercialized.
Right. Yeah.
But it was definitely a gray area, because you could argue that it was still subsistence. But because customary trade, which can involve cash, is something that's allowed. But the harvest was not sustainable.
They got way out
and
of control.
And look what happened. I mean, it's still unclear whether that population is going. Sometimes opponents of subsistence will point to that hunt and say, "See what subsistence can do." Yeah. But my response to that is, we're not really talking about a subsistence hunt. Yeah. Here,
right.
We're talking about something that became a commercial hunt, and the population, even though they were, many of those hunters were legitimately taking a couple of belugas for subsistence use. Yeah. It wasn't something that was truly indigenous to Cook Inlet. If you want to know about that subsistence hunt, talk to people in Tayona,
right?
Because they were the people that for 1,000 years were taking beluga sustainably.
Yeah. Right. Well, all of this it shows how, as subsistence division researchers, you weren't just doing research. You got involved in these sort of controversial political, biological issues.
Yeah, and then sometimes asked to leave.
but just to digress into the beluga commercial thing, so there's a sort of element of commercial that had been going on in Cook Inlet for a long time, including it being sold to the native hospital, and that it was harvested by... There was a whaling station set up over on the Beluga River.
Why? That's why it's called the Beluga River.
River.
Because that's
anyway.
Not
the there was a commercial. One of the I forgot what the name of the company was, but they had a whaling station there, and Fred Bismarck, Tyonic people helped set up nets and catch. So there was a commercial, and there were people.
Lad. It was called Lad, I think.
I don't remember. L-A-D-D. I don't think that was it. Lad is where Lad is down by Chewett, by the mouth of the Chewett. Yeah. But anyway, so some Tyonic people and participated in harvesting beluga, and it was sold to the native hospital.
Right.
And beluga was harvested by dog mushers as well and fed to their dogs.
Right.
And it was there was a sport. Hunt there. There's sport hunters would go out and hunt belugas, and there was a festival at the Kenai where they went out and got belugas, and they so there was a lot of different ways belugas were you know, being harvested and used. The commercial thing with the hospital went away when they, I guess, when they couldn't get the meat tested or whatever and certified to serve. And but all these Native people coming in from all over rural North Alaska, where they harvested beluga, Bethel and Kotzebue and Nome, they, you know, they harvested beluga, and so when they came here, they could
get local food.
Yeah, they could get their they could get beluga and seal as well. So it was that. But there's anyway, there's a lot more to that story. I'm not gonna go there.
Something that I'm gonna shift the topic a little bit here. I don't know whether you had a chance to look at any of the materials that that Karen put together, but you know, when I started here in the first year, there was an effort underway to repeal the subsistence law, and it culminated in the repeal initiative, and which was, but thinking back to your first 3 or 4 or 5 years here, what was your general experience with interacting with Fish and Game staff? Were you welcomed? Were you suspicious? Was there suspicions? What was your experience?
It was both ways. I mean, I had a degree in wildlife management, and I did my master's work on woodpeckers. So I mean, I was and I worked at the Fish and Wildlife Service. You know, my ex-wife and I still have. We just met the other day with a core group of Fish and Wildlife Service people who are lifelong friends, and they're just wonderful people. And so when I went to the Fish and Game Department, I don't have any problem talking to wildlife biologists, and they learn about it's because I tell them what I did and so on and so forth. So a lot of them are still whatever, I don't know, cautious or not accepting of subsistence, because they'd all go, some people would just talk, subsistence, you know, rah, rah, whatever that means. They were just, I don't know if they were doubtful of what it is or just unknowing. I don't know why they acted like but.
Do you remember the 35 signatory memo?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and a number of, that memo, which was allegedly signed by 35 Fish and Game employees, laid out a case for why the subsistence law should be repealed. And one of the points that they made, or allegations they made, I shouldn't say points, allegation, was that the subsistence division was not supportive of biological management, that it was just simply an advocacy group, that it was collecting social science data, which the department had no business doing. So did you encounter
any of that? I never encountered that specifically, them people saying that, because I think Sfer and I had degrees in wildlife, but most other people were anthropologists. They had degrees in anthropology, right, or sociology.
There were other biologists.
There were, okay. Yeah. So, but I don't know that that's how the other people interacted, because when I was talking to biologists and that, I mean, I could talk about populations of moose or salmon or whatever, and I know what I'm talking about. I know what they're talking about. So when I interacted with the people in habitat, especially, I mean, it was always talking about the biological part of it, okay, and not the subsistence part. Whenever we were talking about forest timber sales and that kind of thing, and the effect of it wasn't so much talking about how those timber sales are. But I remember talking about Lance Trasky and Carl Yanagawa and all these people in habitat. Dimitri Bader. Dimitri, he didn't have any. He was a wildlife biologist. He didn't have any problem with subsistence. Mm-hmm. He and I and Rich Cannon went over to Tyonek subsistence fishing, and they never had a problem, said anything like that. So it was people like Ted Spraker, you know, guys like that, that were just whatever. They're going to be like that no matter what. Okay, so there are people like that, and I don't know about Skoog and all these other old-time people who had their prejudices, but I never really got into any kind of, discussions or arguments or anything. I mean, I think they just kind of went, well, subsistence, and didn't really confront me with it.
Well, I was wondering, too, if the biologists thought they should be doing the subsistence documentation, didn't think the division was needed.
Well,
I don't remember that.
I don't know whether you remember this, Ron, but one of my first days on the job, you were walking around with me in the office. And there were two commercial fisheries people standing in the hallway. I'm not going to name them. They were both good guys. But you introduced me, and one of them said to me, you know, the subsistence division, we really don't think that what you guys do is something that should be done in the department. It's really the university's job to do what you do.
Yeah, okay. Well, I don't remember that, but I remember where Dan Foster and I had our offices was with down in the commercial fisheries section. We worked with commercial fisheries biologists, and the secretary was our secretary. It was who married her? Dimitri marry her? I think Dimitri married her. Lenora.
And, no, I don't remember.
And so she was our secretary. No, it was another woman.
It was
but she was our secretary. She was the commercial fisheries secretary. And we did everything. All our paperwork and everything was with commercial fisheries. And they never seemed to have a problem with that. And they might have had their biases or prejudices and said something like, and maybe, I mean, I could see that. I could see that kind of argument. I could see, yeah, maybe this is social science research rather than, you know, but.
So what did it take for the department to become more accepting and realize this social science research was important?
Well, I think part of it was what Ron was saying, that the biologists wound up going to the communities more and seeing learning the knowledge that people had, appreciating their observations, appreciating how they lived, but generally accepting that perhaps the fish and game management should be open to these things.
And they just, I mean, as we were working with them, you know, getting the permits, or they had permits in the office, or, you know, they were seeing the data come in, and that, I think it just was like, well, this is what we got, and this is it. So I don't know, well, maybe we're stuck with it. I don't know if they said that, but, I mean, there it is. You're here, you're there, you got the, you're going to use the biologists, we're going to list the subsistence caught data in their reports, and it's there. And so that maybe that's it.
What about the boards?
Oh, but before, let's talk about the boards. But before that, you know, Ron was talking, he mentioned a number of the habitat biologists, and I never heard any habitat biologists criticize anything that we did. And in parts because they saw the value of documenting ways of life and importance for defending habitat.
Right.
Yeah, that this was information that, you know, not Board of Game, Board of Fisheries, but basically fights over development and managed development, and they could use that information that we collected to build a case to support habitat. What in some of the readings that I've been doing lately that I'd read 40 years ago and not since, it's interesting that when the subsistence law was passed in 1978, the department established this working group. Like even before Lahner was hired, before anybody was hired, this working group to talk about implementing the subsistence law. And one of the major things that it was alleging is that you really didn't need a subsistence law, because if you look at the regulations, especially for rural Alaska, it was pretty open.
I remember hearing that kind of thing. Yeah,
you really didn't need the law. We were taking care of subsistence.
Right. And yeah, I can see that perspective, you know. But if I'm not going to make an argument for it, but you could see how somehow they could have built in that kind of regulatory process or recognition of uses. They could have built it in had they been of the mind and open mind to do it.
Yeah.
They could have done that. But that's not the politicians in the state, whether it was just the biologists or the Fish and Game Department or whoever had this stereotype or how, wherever they came with that, which is, I mean, this stuff kind of thing goes way back to, you know, Native people all over.
Yeah.
I mean, right. You know, go to Lower 48, you still, and look at what the, and look what's going on today in the Lower 48 with Native tribes trying to get their rights to, in New York, they're trying to get Native people there are fighting for their rights to the natural resources, to the fish and game. They're, this is going on right now.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the Bolt decision and these kinds of things out west. This stuff goes on today.
Yeah.
And here we, and now it, I'm not going there with what this administration is like.
And so, yes, if they had done it differently, they wouldn't have needed the, they, the well, 78 law happened because they hadn't done it.
Well, that, well, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
That, that it, it's true that, that there were more liberal bag limits and longer seasons in rural areas. But when push comes to shove, like in Tyonek,
right.
Yeah. nobody acknowledged that, that there should be some priority or preference or acknowledgement
right.
there. So the idea that that the law was not needed ignores the problem that when push comes to shove, this subsistence was shoved out of the way.
Right, especially as that rural-urban divide started developing.
And then after the oil pipeline and all these new people start coming to Alaska, people who they think that they have the rights to everything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And look at how many people we have. As the population's growing, how are you going to deal with that? How are you going to manage with it? You know, so
yeah. And that's exactly why the law was passed.
Yeah, right. There you go. So there, that's what happened, and that's just.
But you were going to ask about the boards.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the Fish and Game staff and their potential resistance, and then coming to some understanding. How did that work with the boards? Because
to the boards.
What's your experience
with the boards? Well, understand? You said like with Dr. Tyonek, they said no, you don't need that, and then they were sued. So how did that progress?
Well, we were requested to bring information to the board. So some of us early on, before it became, it fell just upon the supervisors and certain people to go there. The others of us went to the board and told what we were doing and what we saw and presented information to the boards, and that was what it, and that's what we did. I don't remember being abused or like sometimes Jim
you weren't some grilled.
Pretty bad treatment, but I don't, I mean, that's what we did. A couple of us went there and did that, and but after a while, of course, it was more focused so that the regional supervisors would go and present, or the directors were there, you know, division directors were there, deputy directors, and present information. But if we were asked to provide information, I think I went and talked about the moose up there and fish at Tyonek and, you know, sat and talked. And I think Dan, I don't remember if Dan did too, but, you know, we went and were asked to sit. And sometimes we'd sit in the chair of the subsistence people. But that went away eventually, which was probably just as well, because when you're going to the board meeting, you kind of want to know who all the characters are and how to talk to them, you know, how to be political and not get carried away or just not know how to do it. You know,
that's what I was wondering, is
how
that
to deal with the board of game because or fisheries, because those guys are, I mean, they're looking for ways to do whatever they're going to do to find out. Or whatever, you know.
So as a researcher presenting your results, was that like being an advocate, or are you?
We were accused of that.
Sure, because you're. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't remember ever saying anything from an advocacy standpoint. Saying what people did, maybe other people would interpret that as.
Yeah,
you're being of course, you're a sport fish, and you just talked about how all the sport fishermen are, the commercial fishermen are doing stuff.
Right.
So aren't you doing advocacy? Is even worse. Those guys were even worse as advocates. So, no, I don't know if any other staff from over ever sounded like that. I think when I remember going to listen to Mag Dance or other people present at the board, which I don't remember them talking like these Native people deserve this or whatever. I don't remember ever hearing anything like that. But I didn't go to most of the board meetings after some years, so.
And then after, you know, that original Tyonek one, you mentioned the people from Tyonek testifying and, and getting very emotional. But at other board meetings, were local users testifying, or it was just
absolutely.
Sure.
Okay, it wasn't just the researcher.
You know, one of the things that we did, and give us credit for encouraging the local advisory committees, going to the committees and saying, you know, you need to participate. It's up to you if you want this. It's your responsibility. And these, here's your opportunity through the advisory committees. And they did. You know, sometimes the advisory committees waned because there weren't any issues, so they didn't just send somebody or submit a written report or whatever. So sometimes they waned, and other times they waxed when they had issues. But we encouraged them to, because that's the venue you have to go there, and you can get your way paid, and you can, you know, go to the board and you can present, and that's what you do. Mm-hmm. You can talk as an advocate for yourself all you want.
And I have to admit that I don't think we coached people, but
I don't
remember coaching anybody. But sometimes somebody would come from a community, and they might have never been in a fish board or a game board setting, and it's incredibly intimidating. It's intimidating for us sometimes.
Yeah, right.
And so we still do this. We would explain to them how it works, and to speak the truth and speak from your heart and make your point very clearly.
Yeah,
a lot of people were very, very effective in doing that, and some not as much.
But that's the process that the state has to do it, so that people have to know how to do it. So you tell them how to do it. It's not like,
well, it's a public process.
It is. Yeah. It is the public process. That's all there is to it. Mm-hmm. And if you want that to work, then people need to know how to do it. And so we told people how to do it, how it worked, not necessarily what to say for themselves, but here's, if you have data and you want a report, we have this, you can use that or whatever.
So, I can remember a couple of times when an issue was before a board, and we presented data and so forth. But what made a difference was the person from the community showing up and talking about what it meant to them.
Absolutely.
What it really, really meant to them. And you know who was really... who did a fantastic job, and that was Arnold Melsheimer.
Oh yeah,
from Nate Wallach, who was this non-native guy. I guess was he a teacher?
He was a teacher, yeah.
Teacher there, and he married in.
Yeah.
And he's the guy they would often send. Not always, but other people would come from Nate Wallach and Port Graham too.
Yeah, yeah.
But he had this folksy way of talking, and one time he was just talking about what it was like to live in Nate Wallach. And he was choking up, and he just said, "Let me tell you, it is a joy. It is a joy," he said. And and you know, whatever they wanted, they got at that point, you know.
And it was.
Yeah.
It was. There's no question about that. It is a joy to live in Nanwalk. It certainly is. Still is.
Well,
it
is. Were there times where, you know, your studies and data were ignored by the boards?
I would say so. Yeah. Let me think about some cases like that where things didn't go particularly well. Early on, I actually remember an example. I was there. But before I give this example, and I shouldn't be taking Ron's time, but what was I going to say? In terms of board interaction, a lot of it depended upon who was on the board and who the chairman was. That made a big difference. But the Fish Board was meeting, and I was pretty, I think this was in early 1982, and it was doing a proposal that I think Nanwalek or Port Graham had put in regarding clams.
Oh, yeah.
And they hadn't done a C&T finding for
customary
it.
Traditional.
And so they had to do the customary traditional finding. And the board chairman alleged that the only marine invertebrate that they traditionally used in any kind of quantity for any kind of importance that they really, quote unquote, needed were clams. So they were going towards making a finding that only clams had customary traditional uses, into which is absurd. And Denny Kelso raised his hand and said, well, you know, Mr. Chairman, we've collected this information that we've already presented from the calendars that we had shown. Maybe you were actually the one that showed the calendar information, this whole variety of resources. And then, in fact, they'd already done a C&T finding on salmon. And one of the criteria is a wide diversity of resources. And among that diversity was all these marine invertebrates that people use there. And so Denny was making this case, and the game board, the fish board chairman, gaveled them out and said, that's enough, Denny. And they sure enough did a negative finding for everything but clams, which we eventually fixed. But it took a while. It took for a transition to new board members. And what he was thinking about was making a C&T finding for crab, and that it might actually jeopardize the commercial crab fishery there. That's what he was thinking about, which of course it didn't. And it never did, and it never will.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of it had to do with just who was chairing the meeting, and whether there was some board member who would actually speak up and encourage people and ask them the right questions.
Well, it seems like historically, board members are made up of sport and maybe some commercial. There aren't subsistence people very often on these boards.
There was usually one, maybe, but they weren't appointed as such.
Right.
Yeah.
But I can remember, too, as board members who might have been commercial fishermen from Bristol Bay, Dillingham, and that, and people from the villages would come from Port Grammar down Wallach. I don't remember about Tyonic, but they knew what it was about, so they'd ask them questions and kind of, you know, just make them feel comfortable about what they were talking about,
right,
and ask them questions about that they knew they could answer with about what they were doing, and so that they were the board members could make it a more welcoming place.
Right.
And a few of them did that. I remember hearing board members asking questions that were, oh, that's a good question to ask this person from Dan Wout, Pat Norman, or whoever was there, mm-hmm. you know, from Port Graham, and so some of them are, but that, like you said, it's all about those guys and their stereotypes, and if they lived in Sandpoint or Falls Pass, or who were the ones from Dillingham that always I want to say Samuelson.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
And so
yeah, Robin Samuelson's
a
good example.
And so
he was a commercial fisherman,
but
was also a subsistence fisherman.
Yeah, from Dillingham. Yeah,
yeah.
And so like, wow, you know, they know.
It seems like nowadays, and with many members on those boards have no background in fish and game management or anything,
right.
You know.
Absolutely.
And I just didn't know if back then what the level of knowledge and experience was.
Wow. Who knows?
It was mixed, but there were plenty that brought their prejudices to the table, and they weren't shy about exhibiting them up front.
Being appointed by the governor, right? So they got all the power now.
Right.
So.
Yeah. And there, I think back in those first meetings that we're talking about that Ron attended, and then when I got there in 81 and 82, the repeal initiative was hanging out there. And there were those in the department and on the boards who figured the subsistence law and the division were going to go away.
Right.
Yeah.
So why invest a whole lot of time and effort in this when it's just going to be a bad dream?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I just made a note here, too. When Dan and I went to meet with Sam McDowell and Bob Penny that time at Lion.
Oh, you did?
Oh, didn't you remember that?
It's before me, I think.
Oh, well, we went to meet with Sam McDowell and Bob Penny, and I can't remember. I think they asked to talk to some people, talk to us in the subsistence division about subsistence and that. So Dan managed to find Sam McDowell, and he had the phone number, and so I called him, and he had all his fishing tackle stuff stored at this storage place right up here on the other side of Fish and Game Office. There was a storage place. So we went there, and he had the door open, and it was just, I mean, it was filled with fishing rods and all kinds of fishing equipment. Okay, so we talked for a little while. But then we eventually ended up meeting with him and Bob Penny over at the Golden Lion. And so we went there, and we just had coffee, and they were asking, I think what they were trying to figure out was who could be a subsistence user.
It was a big question then.
Yeah, and that was what it was. It wasn't a contentious thing, but it was like we kind of went away laughing because we knew what subsistence people were like and doing. But I think it was, if you ask Dan, he probably remember that we were like, they were clueless, you know, about what subsistence is and who could be a subsistence user and why or why not. I don't remember if they got, if they were dismissive of subsistence, but they didn't like it, you know. And same with Warren Olson and, you know, those guys.
Dale Bondurant.
Bondurant. And Olson. And they used to come to the office, sit in Jim's office.
You remember that.
Well, especially Bondurant.
Yeah, I mean, we shouldn't talk ill of the dead. But,
no.
But he was a very strong opponent of the subsistence law. Dale Bondurant was, he would combine with his brother, who had some developmental issues, and I give Dale incredible credit for caring for his brother the way he did. So he had a good heart in that respect, but he didn't like what we did. And he didn't like what we stood for, and the problem for me was how did I politely get him out of my office? And some of the people that were down at the front desk, they would warn me, you know, Dale Bondurant's heading your way. So what I would tell somebody is that, you know, give him a half an hour, and then knock on my door and say that you need me for something. And I think that's an old trick that a lot of people use.
Yes.
But he just thought that he was being treated unfairly, and I would listen and I would try to. But he was the kind of guy, and I think several people were like this, that it was hard to get a word in edgewise. I mean, he would try to respond, but he really wouldn't let you. And those guys, you know, they did. Eventually, in some ways, you would say won, because they were the McDowell litigants, and they at least overturned the state law and then prevented the legislature from acting in a way that would have got us back in compliance. And so they're also responsible for dual management.
Yeah, so I was telling somebody, Judy, about this the other day, about how the legislature... Why didn't they put it on? It was supposed to be an initiative. It was supposed to be on the ballot, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, the legislature had to adopt a constitutional amendment.
Yeah, okay.
By, I think it was 2/3 majority. And then it would have gone to the vote of the people. And then it just needed a simple majority.
Right.
And it never made it, that 2/3. It failed. Okay. The first time they voted, it failed by one vote.
Okay.
In 1990.
I knew that it was something. Yeah, okay. So it was very narrow. Yeah. And had it gone to the voters, voters would have passed it.
At that time,
prominent,
yes.
Yeah.
Not sure that's true now.
Well,
but not now.
Yeah. But then it was.
Yeah.
People didn't have at least a majority of people probably had a good view of subsistence, and it was something that, you know, this is the way Alaska is. This is the culture, Alaska culture stuff, you know.
People were willing to concede that in times of shortage, you had to make certain calls about things, and that certain communities or people should be at the front of the line.
Well, it seems like so much of the subsistence debate and arguments back and forth and they forget the part of in times of shortage.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
like they yeah. think it applies yeah. all the time, and it's yeah. like, no, it's yeah. in times of yeah. shortage.
Yeah, boy. although this is probably a topic that you might want to ask me about, because I can think about it and talk about it, but the boards and the department early on, they did do some things to try to make people angry. Mm-hmm. And that the Cook Inlet action by the Fish Board to not only make a negative CNT finding for those set net fisheries, but not open up any opportunity. That was designed to say, yeah. you want subsistence? Here's subsistence.
Yeah, yeah.
And you don't get any.
Right.
And wildlife, well, the game division back then, they wrote these 35 proposals, game proposals, that were deliberated in 1982 that were very extreme in limiting subsistence opportunities to local people in a way that was unnecessary. And it was yeah. quite a debate. These were headlines in the newspaper back then. So the idea was to convince people that the subsistence law was going to hurt them, was
yeah,
going
sure,
to limit them.
Sure, yeah.
When in fact, there was really no example where actions to protect subsistence eliminated non-subsistence uses,
yeah.
non-commercial non-subsistence.
Right.
So.
Interesting. So what other... We did Tyonek, Norwalk, Port Graham, the moose hunt.
Skwentna.
Other big issues that you focused on?
Well, the migratory bird issue, that's after, I thought, this period we were talking
right.
about having in 1997. Well, migratory bird, subsistence, migratory bird harvest.
Ron was our lead.
I got
okay.
involved in that. Yeah. Okay, well, when... the Migratory Bird Treaty Act was amended in 96 and 97, then the state and the feds here in Alaska had to deal with how to manage the migratory bird subsistence
spring and summer
right.
ruling. Yeah, so so I don't know how we ended up.
Well, Bob Wolf had been involved
yeah,
earlier,
Bob,
even in the 80s, and we had routinely collected that information as part of our survey. So
oh, yeah.
we were the ones that had the experience in collecting the data.
Yeah, we did. But it was not just the data, because they created this a board called
yeah,
Migratory Bird
Co-Management Council,
which was a co-management. Cooperative management.
No.
And so I was one of the people who presented the data. We had the division director on that. Matt Robus was one of the members of the thing. Different. Tom Rothy came to those meetings. He was a waterfowl biologist. I went there. Cynthia Wentworth from the Fish and Wildlife Service, because she was the lead at the Fish and Wildlife
mm-hmm.
Service. So she and I worked hand in glove work developing a monitoring instrument to go out and go to villages throughout the Aleutians, Copper Basin. I did all that. I did all Cook Inlet. But we also helped people from the villages came and testified about their use of the birds and the areas, because the problem was to do with who's going to qualify to be able to get to harvest birds under the subsistence provision in the springtime.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. It's all about spring hunting.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so people from Tyonek, Daniel Standifer came. He presented a lot of information. And we figured out rules for the area that would be included.
You see, they were going to get knocked out, weren't they, Tyonek?
Well,
they had to fight their way in, I think.
I'm not sure how bad, because it ended up with the whole Unit 16 as their bird hunting area.
Oh, okay.
So they could go anywhere over there, but nobody else could. I mean, only Tyonek Village, someone from Tyonek Village, or who had been a village resident or relative who was invited. That's the way it worked.
Yeah,
you could
yeah.
be invited. You could go there and hunt birds or gather eggs in the spring.
Right.
But we came up with the whole area. Same with Port Graham and Nanwalek. You know, I don't think there were any limits. There were no limits on it, but where you could go and the timing of it.
Right.
Then, and then same thing with the Aleutian Island communities. I went out there and went to all these places. The Copper Basin was the same thing, working with Joe Neil Hicks over there and visiting the villages and interviewing people about their bird harvest and when they did it and all that, and then present that to this co-management council, and they came up with rules. There are sets of rules that are, you know, in the Federal Register that they figured out how to do it.
And I think it is important to, like Ron said, that this occurred later on. This is in the late 90s, and this is after the division's program had been going on for almost 20 years, and so we were not strangers in most of these communities, and this is a highly sensitive topic, to say the least, and we were able to pull it off.
Well, then, how about marine mammals? How did that happen? Where did that come from? Marine mammals, harbor seals and sea lions.
The Marine Mammal Protection Act, right?
Yeah, but we were asked by NIMFS to develop a harvest monitoring program for sea lions and harbor seals, which we did for about 10 or 12 years.
For Cook Inlet?
No, for statewide. Oh, it was with the range of them, and we didn't do it, but we helped facilitate the development of a Harbor Seal Commission. We work with the Sea Otter / Sea Lion Commission, and we did what I considered to, and a lot of people consider to be a pretty good job in making estimates of sea lion and harbor seal subsistence harvest, which we're talking a lot of communities here. And you played a role in that.
Oh yeah.
Early on? Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Were you the lead initially for that, or?
I don't know who was. I mean, I went to all.
Oh
these
no, it was
places.
Craig Mishler. It was Craig Mishler.
Oh yeah, right.
Who was the
and
lead?
I went to all those communities out there for the same thing, setting up with people in on Alaska.
Well, that's right. You went out to the Aleutians with Lisa and Craig.
Osterbach, Peggy Osterbach.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Because they had their little Peggy Osterbach had this group that was an environmental monitoring group, so we partner with them, and I mean, Tyonek, we, asking people there.
Yeah.
I don't remember how or whether or not what was being, I think it was after the prohibition on beluga whales that some, that was happening, so there wasn't.
That's right.
Seals, because seals, people can still go hunt seals.
Here. Oh, yeah.
Some people still do. From Anchorage, go seal hunting here or down in Kashmak Bay, mostly, or Prince William Sound. But yeah.
Well, it is just that you did have to cooperate with the biologists because you were collecting the data on a harvest, but they're monitoring the population and what's a sustainable hunt. I mean, you guys aren't making those decisions.
No.
The board is, you say to this Migratory Bird Council, you present the data, then they make the rules.
Well,
sure.
The rules are actually made by somebody else, but they make recommendations what the rules should be. And another way that we interact with the biologists who are using this information is that our information isn't just swallowed hook, line, and sinker. I mean, it's evaluated. Maybe over-evaluated in some cases, but everything that we've ever done has been subject to review and criticism and revision, and not everything that one attempts to do works the first time, and a lot of the things that we're describing here, we had to not necessarily invent from scratch because we were using some Canadian models, but for this state, we had to invent a lot of the lot of the methods.
Absolutely.
And test them out and fix them and reject them in some cases.
Well, but, who was reviewing? The biologists were reviewing?
Yeah, and people and the communities and the regional organizations that represent the communities would review our information. They didn't necessarily just say, oh, all this is 100% correct.
Well, and I was thinking your migratory bird example was very quantitative. This is the harvest data. And when you first started, it was a more ethnographic type thing. And
no, that we just were after the numbers. Cynthia and I developed a calendar pictorial thing that we left in communities and households, and then they could record what they got. There wasn't, well, it wasn't written from in an ethnographic standpoint. It was just mostly numbers.
But the original.
I never authored any waterfowl report, harvest reports. I gave the data to data management, and they, giving them the calendars. Right.
But that's different than when you first started in the division, like the work you did in Tyonic.
So in those reports, in our technical report series, that's, waterfowl information, ethnographic descriptions of the way they did things and how they did it.
And maps.
Maps and all that. So in those reports. But after we got the official responsibility for collecting waterfowl, spring waterfowl harvest data, there's a difference because we didn't collect other than in our other, the normal way of collecting harvest information from communities and ethnographic information, we didn't collect fall harvest, everything outside of the spring and summer, part of the summer, for waterfowl. But you might find that in the bigger reports from a particular community, because that's one of the standard things we collected was how many ducks and geese and whatever, gulls and gull eggs and stuff that you collected. So
I was just wondering how you felt about doing the ethnographic kind of studies and reports versus just the counting.
That's what you had to do in order to give it context. You had to have how they did it, where they did it, when they did it, how they shared it, because those are all the standard ways of. There's a list of different things.
Those criteria.
How you share the criteria.
And so based on all of that, you end up with an ethnographic document.
I think a lot of that was established by the time that the harvest monitoring started.
A lot of
the ethnographic
just a way of doing it
work had already been established.
So that's partly,
and not just by us.
But that's partly why the division's methods shifted. Was you did the ethnographic first, and then now you didn't need to keep doing it, and you started doing quantitative?
Well, I think we've always continued to do ethnographic work, but I think the demand and interest in the quantitative became more important. And I think that that agencies, including our own, had developed more confidence that you could collect accurate information directly from people. Because early on, I think there was some skepticism about whether people would tell the truth.
Right.
Yeah. What can you believe them?
Yeah.
Well, and how do you know if they were telling the truth?
Well, for one thing, you could look at the calendars and the permits that people in Tyonic and elsewhere kept. And like I said before, they've got fish blood and guts all over them. People were writing on there. So, but you also build a database over time, and you compare communities, you compare patterns, you evaluate trends, and you make determinations about whether the information looks legitimate or not. It's not a single survey that you do, it's multiple surveys.
Right. And you know, like with the fish, if it's a bad year, or the tides are bad, or the run is low, you know, then maybe your numbers are going to be low. And probably were, and so there was that contextual information that went along with a lot of that, especially just the annual stuff, annual reports, and you know, that sort of thing. So
And you can compare communities that are similarly situated and see not what their general harvest levels are, but especially the composition of harvest. That really came out in the Exxon Valdez oil spill, where the kinds of changes that occurred were across communities, and it's not something people can make up. You're interviewing hundreds of people, and these patterns emerge year after year.
Right.
There's no conspiracy to fool us.
Right. Okay.
So for the skeptics, there was no way to deal with that. Yeah. So,
Oh, we've been going for, what, 2 hours and 20 minutes, maybe?
No, not quite that long.
I wondered about that. Oh, that was going to work, but that's fine. We can keep talking. We can come back some other time if you're in town, because there are other... Let's see about other things that I could talk to, because a lot of this... I mean, so we kind of covered experience as a subsistence researcher, right? You got that.
Yep.
Right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And... evolution of subsistence research over time. I mean,
we've talked about
just
that.
Were talking about that.
I wasn't going to talk about it. Jim can talk about that. It's sort of you can get some of that key political issues. That's something that I'm not well versed on.
Yeah. So as a researcher, you didn't get involved in the political issues.
I tried that. Honestly,
except for visiting, but. McDowell and
visiting
Bob Penny.
McDowell and Bob Penny.
That took some nerve, some courage to do that.
But yeah, you didn't get into the whole rural, urban, native, all that legal mumbo jumbo.
Sounds like you did a good job.
But I didn't personally get into any debates about that. But if Jim is in other division directors and different. Those are the guys that are going to deal with that, right?
But did it affect any of your research, those changes in state management or federal management and rural native preference?
I don't know. Did it change the way we did things?
Did it affect the work you did? Or?
Well, other than when McDowell got rid of the rural preference, then we had to start issuing subsistence permits to people in Anchorage who wanted to go to Tyonic fishing, because then anybody could be a subsistence user.
Right.
But they had to go to those places. So that changed the way we did things, and people would come to our office and ask, you know, can I get a subsistence fish from Tyonic? And I would say, do you know what you're doing when you're going over there?
Yeah.
Because I was a commercial fisherman, and let me tell you, I spent some harrowing days out here on Cook Inlet, and it's not a friendly place to be when the wind's blowing out of Turnagain Arm, and it's not a place you want to go to Tyonic, because they're right in the... So I would tell people who came into my office and get a permit, you better know what you're doing, because your life is in danger here, okay? Plus, you have to know the rules about going where you can put your foot on the land and where you can't, because you couldn't go below the high tide mark.
Private
because
property.
You're on private property, and the fishery occurs in the Tyonic sub-district, which has a boundary, an outer boundary and an upper boundary. So you got to be within that and be aware that people over there might, if they don't know who you are, there might be some hostility. that's how it would change the people who were going, especially to Tyonic. Now, the same thing happened down... Now, Soldovia eventually got a subsistence thing, too, so we had a similar scenario of things in those two sub-districts, in the Soldovia and the Port Graham sub-district, because people from Homer, they wanted to go over there subsistence fishing with a net, but to go down to Port Graham and Nanwalek is another one of these... on Cook Inlet experiences that you better know what the heck you're doing. And so most anybody who was going to go down there and lives in Homer, probably if they have a boat, they're going to know some. But I never had any people going over there. I never had anybody from outside. Now, Soldovia was different. There you had my dentist, the old-time dentist who was from Anchorage. He had a place down there. He got a permit. We had Judge... Who was the judge that got the permit that time and didn't turn his permit in? He was a judge, and he had a place. And so there were a lot of non-local people who went there and got permits in Soldovia and were fishing around. But again, it's real tricky. You really have to know. You can't just go and set your net anywhere, because you have other people to deal with who are fishing there and who have their fishing sites set up, maybe for commercial, and you go there and you see a buoy and you're going to put your... No, you can't just do that. And so it's a thing that you have to know. And I wasn't explaining it to people who were going to do that. But I would explain it to people who were going to go across here because their life was in
right.
in danger here to go out on Cook Inlet. It's a serious place.
Yeah, well, one of the political things I was sort of thinking about is, Jim, you've mentioned this about, you know, defining customary and traditional, or Lawner talks about, you know, barter, and making some of these policy, I guess, mm-hmm. decisions and your research having to be used as evidence for those things. And but, if you got involved in any of those, I don't know exactly how that worked.
Yeah, I think, you know, what Ron was doing, I don't think that affected it at all. I mean, what he was doing, we might use, but I don't think that the McDowell decision changed profoundly the studies that we, you know, what studies we were going to. Maybe we did some additional ones, but or how we went about things, and the effects in terms of regulations and so forth, other than, you know, just dealing with urban people now not knowing what they're doing and so forth. That fell more to me than to Ron or to...
You were the director?
No, I was a regional program manager and then then the research director. But, you know, and this, you can talk to me about this instead of taking up Ron's time. But just to say, one of the things that happened, of course, is when all Alaskans were eligible for subsistence permits, then for some of the most accessible wildlife populations, it had customary traditional uses and had been limited to rural people, all of a sudden all urban people could go out and theoretically hunt like Nelchina caribou. Right. So immediately you get into a restricted situation where you had to limit who could get a permit, and it was up to us to come up with procedures for doing that. That hardly ever happened before. So there were some regulatory tasks that developed.
I guess I was wondering whether the researchers had to go and collect extra information.
There might have been a study or two but generally no.
Okay.
No, like the moose hunt now. There's a subsistence moose hunt over by Tyonek, but anybody could apply for it. They have to go through the permitting, through the criteria process in order to get a permit, right? To get a moose permit over there. So you fill out a form that says how many years you've used the moose meat or how much gasoline. So they still do that, right? Well,
only if it's tier two.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It still is tier two.
Right.
They have to fill out and they get a score.
Right.
And the people with the highest score
get
the permits.
So, but that's just a more of a way of the way the department has to structure its permit process.
I mean,
that's not so much that we had to do research on to find out who in Anchorage is going to go moose hunt.
Right.
People have to submit themselves to the process and be evaluated whether or not they could meet the criteria.
So. We helped the board justify the criteria or the questions that they were developing. So we would help with that, and that's grounded in our understanding of what subsistence is and how.
Right.
But it's not something that was really researched or changed in a major way.
And you know, you mentioned in Tyonek those early days how you were so accepted into the community. Did that continue? Did you continue to have acceptance in other places?
So,
or did that change over
after
time?
I retired from the division in 2007, I became a board member on the Tyonek Tribal Conservation District. That was a Department of Agriculture. Tribal governments could establish a conservation district done throughout the lower 48. And here we have tribal conservation districts, and it's a way that they can look after the resources in not just their own corporate and village lands, but on all the lands within a certain area of jurisdiction, like all of Unit 16. B is the Tyonek Tribal Conservation District. And so what they do is with all this, we got together all these stakeholders who are of any kind of interest, oil and gas companies, people living out in the rural areas, in the village or wherever, and we got together and formed this group. So it was the village's initiative to do it. So I did do that for 8 years. I was a board member on that for 8 years. Oh, the other and subsequent to that, or at the time of that also, I was involved with the Native American Rights Fund as a co-researcher on the Tyonic, what we call end up calling a cultural landscape. It had to do with how Tyonic's use of resources and the history of the area somehow might be affected by the coal mine, but it was mostly just to document what we ended up calling was the cultural landscape, the way the culture is attached to the whole landscape right. over there. It's a bigger, it's a newer, sort of not new, it's but a it's newer, a new concept newer, yeah. in the way you describe, rather than in the way the National Park Service looks at cultural properties, or and it's not just a property, it's not just an individual right. thing, but it's a large. So that's the way we dealt with. But I was involved with that for 4 or 5 years with the Native American Rights Fund. So subsequent, but that was because the village asked me to do it.
Right. You know. I was thinking other communities you worked with, you know, through the years, was that acceptance of yeah. outside researchers coming
yeah.
in
yeah. Yeah.
always positive?
I'm a tribal member.
No, I'm other places than
tribal Tyonic. Member of Tyonic.
Well, other than Tyonic.
Other than yeah, Tyonic.
Well, there are other places.
Port Graham and Aniwalik, they have their, they have a Chugach-Miu Regional, they have a Chugach Regional Resources Commission that kind of dealt that. Tyonic doesn't have that kind of entity to work with,
yeah.
whereas the Chugach region has a Special Resources Commission that has addressed many of those kinds of issues in their region. So, but Tyonic didn't have that.
Oh, but so what? Nowadays, those communities around the state are doing their own subsistence research. Because I'm just wondering now how subsistence researchers are accepted into the community mm-hmm. or not, well, the way it was in the old days.
I don't think that the dual management changed anything in that. There are communities that decline to be part of a project. That does happen.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple, there are a few examples, not many, but there are a few where we've had to terminate a project because of people being suspicious or some unfortunate thing happens.
Yeah. I don't know about it.
I think for the most part we've been accepted, and I'll tell you a story. Ron and I went to False Pass to do surveys.
Yeah.
I was doing an interview with a guy, and he'd been drinking a little bit, but it was okay to interview him. But this other guy walked into the house, and he had been drinking a bit more.
Way more.
And so he stood over me as I was doing this interview, and who should show up at the door but Ron? No, actually, he decided to leave, and we had arranged to meet at this house,
yeah.
And so he met you on the steps,
yeah.
right, and went through the whole thing again, and then Ron came in, and we finished the interview. Well, that story went around in the community, and not pointing at us, but pointing at that guy and
yeah.
how and how disrespectful that was.
Yeah.
And there were a couple, there were several guys there who, you know, they had a little bit to drink, and we hadn't been able to contact them. They started calling us. When are you going to come and interview me? Yeah. So there was this view that it was really valuable
mm-hmm.
to do this,
yeah.
and you know, we never did interview the guy that told us no, don't come.
He couldn't.
In fact, that's what he said. Don't come to interview
yeah,
me. And I
yeah,
think Ron
well.
Said, "Oh no, we won't.
Don't worry.
And, yeah, don't worry. We won't bother you.
Go home and
yeah,
never mind."
But I think that's the general view is
yeah.
that despite who's managing, and I think a lot of people and communities distinguish between the decisions that regulatory boards make and what we do. Not always, but for
yeah.
the most part, they see a distinction there, and they don't hold us responsible for it. They still see a value in what we do, even if it doesn't work sometimes, you know?
I mean, I got the story when the staff in the last couple of years went with Willow Hetrick from the Willow from the I think they went down to Port Graham, and so I was getting calls. Okay.
Oh yeah.
What are they doing now? I said, "Don't worry, it's okay. You could. They're trying to understand what you do." Well, okay. So here's the thing. I don't know if you want to record about this, but it's about the view of subsistence and management of subsistence by native people that was brought up as a resolution at last fall's AFN. Mm-hmm. You know about that, right?
I don't think it was the first time that
it's not
up.
Yeah. But it's been resurrected, shall we say?
Yeah.
They wrote another resolution, mm-hmm. Sky, Patty Brown, three or four other people, prominent people from the Otna region and around the state were there. And anyway, I don't know if you're going to end up talking about that, but where that, I don't know if you're up on that and what's going on. But Tom Rothe has been asking me, can we get into a discussion about subsistence and how can we work with people on this? Because, you know, the co-management council isn't working. Yeah. Marjorie Burke Co-Management Council isn't functioning anymore.
Yeah.
But waterfowl biologists want, you know,
they want
something, but the state isn't funding it, right? I mean, is it the state that's not funding it?
No, it's the Fish and Wildlife Service. It's not.
Oh, they weren't funding it either or participate. So, but Rothy's like, how can we get together with people and get this exchange going and learn more stuff, learn about, you know, what we learned and what Lily was doing out there, mm-hmm. and now that she's gone and there's nobody over at the Fish and Game Department to.
So is the idea like how the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission, that sort of native management of
Well, it's not native management, is it? I mean, they co-management with
international.
Yeah,
bodies,
right.
But the state has no role in
it. Right,
no,
but is that what you mean by native management of fish and of subsistence?
My understanding of what they want to do is be able to manage their resources on their lands and to have a native preference for native people.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a topic that where subsistence is possibly going
to
go.
So instead of rural, we'll go back to native.
Native, right. Yeah. Native.
Open that can of worms.
Yeah, well, so I think the can has been open for a while. Yeah.
It has, but like I said,
how do you get there?
I watched it on the AFN last fall. I watched Sky and them sitting at the panel talking, and they're like, that's what they wanted.
Yeah.
I don't know how they would do that. I said, that's not going to work. But anyway, that's my opinion. But anyway, then Rothy, I saw him a while back. He was getting some fish from me, and he was like, can we sit down and talk about how can we work with people on this like we did with the, you know, on subsistence migratory birds? How can we do that? You know, he's really upset about it because nothing's happening, you know.
And so he's still involved, huh?
Oh, he gets him. He's involved in, you know, no matter what. I mean, people are going to go to him and... Because he was a state waterfowl biologist. He's been on all these...
And he was extremely trustworthy.
Well, he's pretty trustworthy. Yeah. I mean, I trust Tom. And,
do you feel like all the subsistence work that you did, it made a difference?
I guess so. I mean, I guess you can see the change. You can see, like, this guy, Tom Rothe, he was at the Fish and Wildlife Service when I was there. He moved over to the state. He was a state waterfowl biologist. He has a hunting cabin over there. He invited me to go to his hunting cabin to help him out this fall. So I know these guys. And so that, to me, is they want to know more about it. And he totally accepts the subsistence thing. And he and I worked with, like I said, Daniel Standifer from Tionic. We were all in on that because there are birds over there, the tule white-fronted goose, that's kind of a species of concern. And we wanted to make sure that the timing was right, that people wouldn't get into those birds. So he's all for working with it. You know, right. He wants to know what's going on and how to deal with it. Plus, they have he's no longer he's having problems with a health problem, but he was on these Pacific Seabird. They have these different groups that deal with seabirds and marine waterfowl, eiders and scoters and stuff like that.
I was just thinking whether your reflection on the work of the subsistence division and its impact on regulations and
I guess we have regulations, right, that are still working.
A lot of them. Maybe not all of them.
Yeah, well, how do you feel about having played a role in some of this for yourself?
Well, I was able to retire and live a good life because of subsistence. And I got a good job and I enjoyed it. And it was so much fun. I met so many people and I have so many village people. I am like a brother to many people in the Tyonek, or Port Graham and Nanuwalek and Tyonek, like I said, an honorary tribal member in Tyonek. So, I mean, that kind of explains it. And I've been asked to participate in these different groups, like with Tyonek especially, and help, help them out. And they come to us and ask our help for doing this. So that what greater honor could you get than that,
And you would go back year after year after year to these communities, right?
Well, no, I mean, I don't go back. I don't.
No,
but you did. As if you went to Tyonek once and then 6 years later you went back again. I mean, you were.
You mean while we were working?
Yeah. You went every year for how many years?
Oh, every year, every week, every month.
Right.
Well, for Nanuwalek and Fort Graham for a while, it was every month.
Yeah, and the Tyonek whenever. I mean, so frequently.
You were working with these communities for years.
Oh, yeah.
Not just then go to the next one.
I worked at the division for 27 years, and I've worked with the village of Tyonek ever since.
Right.
Not so much the last few years, but, like I said, the 8 years after that, and then the 4 or 5 years with the Native Rights Fund to represent.
And I don't know if the division is still doing that. If researchers go and spend year after year after year in one place, or
if they stick around within the division, I think we have more people that are around for 3 or 4 years and then move on to something else. That's true of a lot of agencies and a lot of organizations. But I think we still have examples of staff who have been going back to the same places. Lisa Scarborough is a good example. How, she continued to go back to the Chignecks and some other places.
And then
Craig Mishler, my goodness. I mean, he was down in Kodiak all the time.
I guess that also shows that if doing the research, you didn't just go, one point in time and this is the answer. You documented it over time.
We tried.
And the changes.
It seems like once you got established a presence and a working relationship, then there were so many things that, especially during the time I was there, I don't know so much anymore, but when I was there, you were always being consulted, called, or asked for information, or going there to issue permits or something. It's just something that was continually. Now, the Aleutian communities was a little different because that's a little far off and we don't have a person out there. But you sure as heck could have had that kind of presence. If you had an office in Unalaska, I guarantee you would be going to those communities and working like that with them if we had an office out there. But here in this area, like I said, people still call me and ask me questions about...
And at one point, the division did have many offices
than now. We're down to pretty much just what, 3 or 4 places where people live. At Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, is there a fourth even now? There's nobody permanently in Dillingham anymore or Bethel anymore.
Kotzebue.
I don't think so.
Nobody in Kotzebue and Nome. They have offices in Kotzebue, Nome, Bethel,
Galena, Fort Yukon,
Glen Allen.
We never had a person year round in Glen Allen. And Goon.
Oh, really?
Great Gabe That's George right. and Gabe, Matt Kukesh. Yeah. They were from Angoon and they lived in Angoon and they worked in Angoon. That's where they did their work. So that's where it sort of maxed out. And
yeah,
I mean, if
Dillingham had
a, not anymore. Dillingham was the last. I think Dillingham was the last place.
Yeah.
Other than the three centers where we had somebody year round. And I would say, you know, if that is one thing that I would criticize about the direction that things went, I would say that that is not a good thing, because other divisions do a much better job than we do in stationing people
out in the field.
In the field.
Well, that's the problem, because what
Especially wildlife division.
If you look at our interaction with people and their permit participation in the process, that we really made that happen as far as that goes. And and the problem is that without going there on a regular basis and establishing these personal relationships, you know, well, then it's just not, they're not going to be active. They're not going to participate, and they lose interest, and maybe issues overwhelm what they're doing. So they lose their role in their own, you know, livelihood for
people,
their own.
And people retire too.
Yeah.
Or, you know, they're not in the positions of leadership, and somebody else comes in, and we don't have the same kind of relationship with with them. Like,
The other thing quickly, Jim, you had mentioned it, and I don't know if this is something that Ron can speak to, is the when advisory councils and committees started, was that straight from the beginning in 78? That was part of the process to have the advisory committees?
The boards of Fish and Game and advisory committees?
The subsistence advisory committees.
Oh, no. There weren't subsistence advisory committees. Those are just the
advisory
Fish and Game advisory committees that exist.
Yeah, and they existed long before our program. But there was an expansion of the number of them in the early 80s, and I mean, I don't, English Bay and Port Graham had one back then, and I don't think they do anymore. Tyonic got a committee, and so there was a number of new ones, and we made a real effort to work with
But they weren't they weren't set up through the subsistence division.
Okay,
that's all what I was wondering, if there was something to comment on about those. Did you have any other questions there?
No, I think I went through most, just about everything here. I think that's good. We might have a follow-up, more of a, it might even be more of a panel kind of thing. If we, we're just going to have to see where where it goes, but there might be some kind of panel where we raise some of the questions and issues that people bring up and have people exchange.
You could get,
we'll see. You're easy to find.
Well, you could get Craig online. Craig's on Facebook all the time. Him and his wife live in Colorado Springs now. They live in a facility there.
In Colorado Springs, Craig is?
So,
he's not in Arizona anymore.
No, it was too hot in Arizona. But I mean, you can dial up Craig right now. He'll talk to you. I'm on Facebook, and I'm always commenting.
Do you know Craig Michelin?
Yeah, so he's like, he'd be willing, he'd love to talk about stuff, probably.
Yeah, the thing is with Craig is that he's sort of outside of our core time frame.
Same way with
Bill.
Yeah, and that's why
Bill Simeon.
Yeah, you starting back in 1980.
Yeah, I get that, right. Yeah, it's too bad that some of the ones are.
What
about Rick Caulfield?
I guess Rick Caulfield has dementia.
Really?
That's what you said.
I didn't say it. Bill said that.
Bill Simeon?
No,
Bill
Schneider.
Bill Schneider.
Said that we couldn't interview
Rick. And I guess Bill Simeon, I mean, golly,
he's later.
Oh, I see.
So we might get to those people.
But he,
we'll see what happens.
I mean, golly, he's got such a perspective on the caribou and all that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I mean, wow.
Well, we may get to those people. We'll see what happens.
The original vision was that there would be these panel discussions about topics, and it probably could have involved more people over a broader time frame. But we just don't have the
resources. And what about Susan Georgette?
She's on the list. Susan's on the list.
I was trying to think back. I was thinking of like Lee Stratton, like you said, and Susan Georgette, and And I forgot about Carrie Reed.
I have no idea where she is.
I don't either. I don't even know where she is. She's alive even. But yeah, I started thinking about all these people that were around for a while but didn't stay with the division.
Well, this, and let's say at this point, we're those early years first.
Yeah, sure.
And then, you
know,
we'll
see where it goes
from there, and what the experiences were like in those first years when you were developing it all.
But it seems like following it up with where we are now, because it's been so diminished in its size and the role it plays. I mean, to be downgraded from a division to...
But that changed again,
Oh, it did. Did it go back to a division? So we have a director now? Oh, okay. Yay.
So it went from section to division?
To section to division.
Oh, really?
Oh, really?
I didn't realize it had...
Well, that's a good thing, is it? I mean...
Yeah, it is a good thing. Yeah, that happened in this legislative session, I think.
Oh, okay.
Or maybe it was even last... It might have actually been the last legislative session, and then it took a while to actually recruit somebody. It's actually Hazel Nelson's husband, George Pappas. Do you know George
Pappas? Oh, yeah, right. Because where did I meet George recently?
He
was at Lisa's thing, too.
Oh,
he was
that's
at
right.
Lisa's.
Not very long, but he was there
for a
while.
Yeah, so he's the director of the
Simpsons. But when it kind of shrunk, you mean its role in...
More just the... Where people are, I think we're not spread out as much.
But its role in...
But they weren't going out to the villages like we used to.
No,
I mean,
they are.
Well, I would people in Port Graham and Walgreens. How come you guys don't come down here anymore? You know, how come you guys don't come down here anymore? And what the point was, and spend some time and like we used to go down there and go fishing and hang out for a couple of days. But that's not happening.
I think it happens in some places, but you are right that I think that perhaps, because what you and Dan and a bunch of others did, Banky, a lot of people, I could name a whole bunch, maybe as much time spent in the villages doing things other than interviewing probably isn't as, but it isn't gone, but I don't think it's as much. But, you know, Nan Wallach and Port Graham was kind of on one extreme in terms of visits. Because not only you, but Rita Morales also, she would go down there all the time, too.
I know.
Yeah, and she loved going down there.
Well, the other thing about...
Didn't she go to Chignik also? Not Chignik.
Rita?
Chignik. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, there's something that I saw in... It was the one with the staffing and hiring local people.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we did a lot of that. We hired a lot of local people and trained them. And like Lillian, she became a member of the Harbor Seal Commission because of that.
Lillian.
Nick Tanappi.
Lillian Elsos.
Huh?
You're talking about Lillian Elsos. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lillian, Nick Tanappi. These people started playing roles on these larger committees than that.
We hired them as non-permanent people to either do surveys or to facilitate key respondent interviews.
During the oil spill, we hired.
We still do
people.
That. That's still done.
Well, but I mean that is something
that it was being done.
You were asking about that.
Right.
It was on their staffing.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And whether the local people were involved and they were hired. More is it temporary? Yeah.
There are a number of local people that were hired in professional or technical jobs. There's Molly Chifluk. There's Port Yukon. Why am I forgetting?
Clarence Alexander.
Oh my God.
There's Matt Kukesh.
Yeah.
Worked for us for a long.
Yeah. Heck yeah.
From Angoon.
What was I going to say here?
So you were going to say about Lillian and Nick in Nunwalloc. Or your examples, right?
Yeah, sure.
Well, Lillian's really just a looking at this.
But wherever any of these bigger surveys, even the waterfowl surveys out in the Aleutians and places, I hired people to help to do
that. And that was done for the whole duration of that project.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's...
Marine mammals too, seals and sea lions too. We brought people in. We had workshops, training workshops, multi-day training workshops. Oh yeah.
And I remember that one, the 10th anniversary one with the Harvest Seal Commission and the, who was the one, was he a NIMS biologist, the tall guy who was there?
Oh, and I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I've got a picture of all of us standing with our drums because they gave us these drums.
Yeah,
but those, you know, they all started interacting with our people we hired from the villages, and it was just one of those things.
You know, I hadn't actually thought about it that way, but that's a really good point, that a lot of people who wound up playing important roles in these regional or statewide organizations, actually, if they didn't start out helping us and getting trained by us, they certainly were trained by us in these training sessions that we had, either in their communities or we brought people in here. That was true of seals. It was true of migratory waterfowl.
Yep.
It's true of multi-community surveys during the oil spill and so
I
forth.
I guess they did the same thing in Southeast. They hired people down there and did all this. I mean, it's a pretty broad reach.
Yeah, and sometimes we didn't hire. We would enter into an agreement with the tribe.
Yeah, right.
And the tribe would actually, because it was easier for them to do it.
Right.
So we would do it that way, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's far-reaching as far as it's, I don't know about other divisions doing that kind of thing. I never heard of them, Wildlife Conservation, hiring people in villages to do anything. Maybe they did for some reason, but tagging bear or like bear tagging, you know, Nick did that. They could get tags over there, so that those kinds of functions, I guess they do. I don't know what they do in Homer anymore with the fish permits. Does the Homer office issue the permits in Port Graham and Nanuag? Because this is where it's fallen short.
Yeah.
Like moose permits in Port Graham and Nanuag, because I get the calls from them most frequently. So you have to fill out a permit in December, by December 15th, and you submit the permit, and you get the criteria, blah, blah, blah. But how those permits get to the village, who's issuing the permits or making them available, has been a problem in Port Graham and Nanuag. And so I don't know who does it, whether the biologist in Homer is responsible for that.
Yeah, that's an example. It goes back to a point a couple hours back that, you know, technically it's Wildlife Division who has the authority for permits, and they basically, quite frankly, cut us out of a lot of that over the years.
So that is a problem, because, again, we got them used to it, and they were looking for it, and then it stopped, and then... So I know. I said, "Well, you got to go online." Well, now you got to go online and do this.
Yeah,
are you kidding me?
Right.
There were just and the whole schedule for applying for permits. Wildlife changed that around, and there was little to no consultation And again, they'll say, "Well, it's our authority."
Right. Well, I can see as a rural subsistence user to have to go through all those hoops.
Well,
to get a permit and to understand all those regulations and the timing and all that, it's so complicated.
Yeah. And it's also a consequence of the McDowell decision, because back when we were when we did have the rural preference, there could be a permit system that was a registration permit. It could be done in the communities, because now if you try to do some of these in communities, people will cry foul. Right, you're giving them you're treating them special. Well, you know, the guy that's complaining about that in Anchorage lives down the block from the office, you know. But he's complaining that because somebody might go to Nanuag to help issue permits, that's not fair. I've heard those kinds of arguments.
Well, so that's I've gotten that.
Yeah,
I've gotten that directly, and I've been away from there for all these years.
Well, I mean, it would make me think that people are going to continue their subsistence practices and just not get the permit.
And you start to lose data again.
Yeah.
It can happen.
Well, it's just that they know they're supposed to have the permit. Where is it? And we need to have a permit.
Yeah, they want it. People do not want to break the law.
No, they don't. They don't want to go out there.
But if it's too complicated, and as you say, the animals are there.
And they got to live.
Got to live. They're going to take them.
Well, they're going to do that for sure. But, I mean, I know down there, especially in recent years, there's more and more boat traffic. Fish and Wildlife troopers and the Coast Guard are out there, and it's kind of, I don't know if it picked up more when the halibut, when we got involved could with be. The halibut thing.
Yeah, it could be.
With the halibut, that there were troopers and were out there more, checking people, checking their,
right.
Well, when you go and you have the excuse as a law enforcement officer to look at the boat's numbers. Oh, you got the boat registered? Oh, how many life vests you got on there? Do you have this? And right. Because there are requirements for having your boat. You have
right.
a boat, and you have, and there are rules
right.
that you have Coast Guard
right.
laws and state. So, by the way, do you? We see you got a bunch of halibut there. How did you catch those? Yeah.
Right.
Do you have a fishing license? Well, no, I have a long one. Oh, do you have your halibut, whatever they have?
Shark card.
Shark card, yeah. And so it starts cascading at you.
Well, it's
more
like
than just a boat registration number or checking if the person has a life vest.
Right. Well, it's like on the roads, if your tail light's out.
Yeah. That's
they
it.
Pull you over,
you
and now
it.
All of a sudden it's a drunk driving.
Yeah, or you right. Or you have a outstanding warrant,
right?
Stuff like that.
Right.
You know, it cascades when there's one little thing that
right.
somebody.
So you say they don't want to break the law; they want to do it. No,
absolutely right. not.
Right.
So anyway, okay. Well, we covered the thing about hiring and people are our influence and
right.
people. Yeah.
Anything else? We've covered it all.
I guess so.
Talked you out.
He's making a noise.
Reviewing the division's strengths and weaknesses. Well.
Well, that's a topic for another day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I
well,
think
I think that I think the what we were just talking about.
Yeah, I mean we
right.
covered
some of
that. Some of
the stuff.
Can,
so
right.
It's
yeah.
pretty. It's interesting. I mean, these are good questions, and
like I say, we could have a follow up.
Right.
Yeah.
Of,
sure.
Of some sort. Yeah.
And the division's, I don't know, where does it say? Does it have its contribution to research, socioeconomic, anthropological research? I don't know if
right.
that's what was that's part of the what the bibliography was about.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
well,
the
yeah.
big contribution that the division has made to a body
yeah.
of knowledge and. And,
yeah, I mean, this is a thought that's coming way too late, but you know, in terms of recognition of our work and so forth, I don't think it's been adequate at the academic level.
Right.
I don't, and then partially it's our fault that you know we've got 500 technical papers and so
yeah.
forth, but they're all part of the gray literature,
yeah.
and for a lot of them, you don't even see them cited. And then
right.
somebody goes to a community from a university, spends 2 weeks, and goes back and writes a professional paper that nobody sees, but all of a sudden they're the expert. These things happen.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And especially since all those documents, they're mostly online, right?
Oh, yeah, they're all
they're
online.
They're
online, yeah.
But still,
they didn't
I mean, if you don't know what to search for, you don't know.
Oh, no,
and
you wouldn't
know even people in the villages, I mean... I can't tell how many times I've told people in Tyonek, there's this one niece of Max's niece. She was posting something on Facebook about, what was it now? It was some kind of traditional Dena'ina jewelry of some kind.
Kankana?
Huh?
Kankana? Dentalia?
No, it wasn't Kankana. But anyway, I saw this and I said, well, you know, you could, here's somewhere you could go and you can look, read this document or whatever and find out about this. And man, she read that and like, and then there was Karen Stanford's daughter. She discovered one of these paper.
One of
these,
our technical papers?
Yeah,
oh.
and she did a whole thing in college on this.
Wow.
You know, it's
no, that's
a,
great.
So,
that's what you want.
But these
right.
are rare, rare things.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so it's like, these documents are certainly not available in the villages just for people to pick up.
They are sent to the villages. What happens to them when they get there is another story.
Well, and you say before they were online, you know,
being
online actually makes them more accessible nowadays because it might come up in a search. Whereas in the old days, all that gray literature, maybe there's a copy at the UAF library or the UAA
library.
Well, there should be, but who knows what happens.
You know, our list,
but it didn't. Yeah. It's much harder to find.
You know, so anyway, okay.
I'm going to turn this off.
Push the button.